Call the meeting to order. This is a meeting of the MPCA Citizens Board on Tuesday, September 23rd, 2014. Welcome, everyone. Call the meeting to order and then ask if you would to review our agenda. It's two information items today, and if so, if it's acceptable, I'd ask for a motion to adopt the agenda.
Move to adopt the agenda.
Motion by Mr. Ibarra. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Mr. Jensen. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The agenda is adopted. The minutes from our last meeting are included, were included in your packet, board members, of our August 26th meeting. And if there's anything, it was a fairly lengthy meeting, and so there's a good amount of minutes there. And if there's any comments or corrections on the minutes, please offer them now. Otherwise, I'd look for a motion to approve. Mr. Riddle.
Yeah, I move approved as presented.
Motion by Mr. Riddle. Is there a second?
I second.
Second by Dr. Drager. Any discussion further on the minutes of the August 26, 2014 meeting? Seeing none, all those in favor of approval of the minutes signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. They are adopted. Let's move on to our legal report. Ms. Olson.
Thank you, Commissioner, board members. I just wanted to update you on one of the things that we do fairly frequently. And a number of times this year, we've been in the court on issues of deficient septic systems for private individuals. And one example is a citizen in Fillmore County. The MPCA initially issued two APOs in 2011 for a deficient sewer system. I believe he has a straight pipe system, so it's just discharging directly out, not in a holding tank, not to a septic system. He didn't fix it, so we went forward to court and issued judgment because the APO would have said if you don't fix it by a certain period of time, this penalty is going to be accruing. So on December 17th in 2012, we got the penalty. Then we went back to court on September 10th, 2013 because he still hadn't fixed it. Court held him in contempt. Went to court again on July 11th, 2014. He again was held in contempt, and the judge at that time issued him a $25 per day penalty. He still didn't fix the system. We were just in court again on September 16th, and again the judge held him contempt and ordered that he has to have a compliant system by November 4th, 2014, or he's going to face even greater penalties, and there's lots of other things the judge can do to him. So we've got a status hearing set for November 4th. That's just one example, but those are unfortunately fairly frequently, and I think I see several of those a month when we're going forward to try and get them to comply with their septic systems.
Thanks. Any questions for Ms. Olson? Thanks. That's helpful. Mr. Jensen.
Commissioner, Ms. Olson, the question I have is it a, and I don't want to get into the legal issues on it, but is it a matter of economics or what's the word I want to use? Opinion, policy?
Thank you, board members. It really differs. In this particular case, the person has a substantial amount of land, many hundreds of acres, and so it's not necessarily a financial issue other than I understand that he doesn't want to sell his land in order to afford it. I don't know that he has any cash flow. So currently, I believe the county's working with him, and the county was the one that initially tagged him for an inappropriate septic system. The county's working with him to try and see if he can get some type of funding, low-income funding. If he doesn't qualify for that, I believe they're doing something where they would pay for the costs and it would be put on his taxes, and so it would be assessed against his property. In other cases, it's simply an opinion. They don't feel like the government should be able to tell them. And in some cases, it is an economic factor. But there are programs out there that they can. So lots of times, they just don't think they should have to.
Mr. Riddle.
Yeah, just a comment. Our Soil and Water District was one of the first in the state to offer a septic system fixes for low-income landowners. Is it 2 years ago, we got funding from the state and corrected quite a few that were on the county's list of failing septics. But a person had to be low income, so they had to also come in and confidentially share their financial information, which is a barrier for some people to even want to do that. But it was quite successful. But now that program, which was carved out as a separate pot of money at the state level, now has been thrown in with all of the other, stormwater, the clean water, competitive grants, and is scored much lower as a priority. And so now, even though we've submitted applications for state funds, we're no longer getting that money back out to the districts to address these problems. So yes, there may be, in theory, money available for low-income septic fixes, but it's very difficult to get that money. And then, it's also demographics where it's hard to get the people to come into government offices and, complete all the paperwork it takes to qualify. So just a comment with some of our experience in Winona County with that.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments for Ms. Olson and her report? We'll move on to my report. Board members, just wanted to touch base on a couple of things. Remember that the governor has been traveling with a few of us commissioners on rail safety and oil transport challenges that Minnesota faces. We had a meeting since our last board meeting. We were out in a couple of places around the state. We've been to Winona and Moorhead and a few other communities during the last month, and I think we may still be planning on a session in Duluth. Mr. Jensen, I thought I'd bring that up, but it's uncertain at this time given the governor's schedule if that will occur. Some interesting perspectives brought to the table by people attending those meetings, primarily concerned about impacts to communities on increased unit train frequency and carrying oil from North Dakota through Minnesota for points elsewhere primarily. A lot of commentary about the legislation that passed in this past legislative session that the governor signed into law dealing with emergency preparedness and response training for local unit first responders. And the Department of Public Safety is their Division of Homeland Security Emergency Management's got the lead on that, so there's a huge training effort underway. We also received funding at the MPCA for one additional emergency preparedness and response staff position, again, to prepare and work with first responders and other state agencies in sort of the development of scenarios and exercises for environmental response planning. Railroads are already required under law to provide for the deployment of their equipment in case of an environmental spill or release. We, with the new funding and the new position, put together a scenario for each of the railroads to respond to, a tabletop scenario in which they would have a theoretical release into the environment, and they'd have to come up with their specific plan for responding, and that was due by September 1st. We let them know about that in late July. They had 30 days to respond and then to conduct additional tabletop exercises with our staff. So that's all of the four major railroads responded on time, and we tried to challenge them. We tried to identify locations on their alignments that would be difficult and problematic for access or for other reasons to deploy their equipment. So we're still reviewing those responses to our scenarios. The other thing I wanted to mention is there will be a large on-water exercise in the Winona in basically in the Winona area later this year in October, November. I don't have the dates. We'll get those dates to you. But it will be sort of again, simulating a release into the river and into the Mississippi River and how the various equipment from the railroads and the other entities would be deployed to coordinate the response under a unified command. So it will involve many local government first responders, as well as state agencies and federal agencies and the rail companies themselves. So look forward to letting you know a little bit more about that once the details, and we can forward that information to you. Second thing I'd mention is last week I was in New Mexico for the Environmental Council of States meetings, which is the meeting I go to twice a year with my peers. And we had a variety of subjects that we were discussing, and primarily the benefit of those meetings is the EPA leadership comes, and there's a full day and a half of face-to-face conversation with EPA leaders. EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy came and addressed the group at one of our luncheon visits and talked about the opportunity of collaborative work between states, tribes, and federal government. We also covered a number of other subjects, 111D, which we'll hear about today, the clean air and clean energy rule that EPA has proposed. Waters of the U.S. got discussed rather extensively, and that was an interesting conversation. As you might imagine, states from all different points of view. Minnesota has a fairly comprehensive set of statutes regarding waters and regulatory responsibilities for waters of the state, so that the impact of waters of the U.S. has to do with sort of the additional regulatory requirements that the federal government imposes over the state laws. But there's a lot of debate nationally over what the EPA's rules on waters of the U.S. is intended to do, and we're still talking in Minnesota about a joint comment letter between a variety of agencies. The Board of Water and Soil Resources, Mr. Jashke, is here, and he'll be speaking later on our agenda. The Department of Natural Resources and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, we're likely going to comment together as a group of agencies on the value of the rule. And if you'd like more information on that, we can certainly hook you up with the folks that are working on it internally. But one of the primary challenges facing the EPA on waters of the U.S. is that courts have interpreted that definition variably across the country. And so the rule that they're proposing is to try to put some consistent approach to definition of waters of the U.S., and many people are characterizing it from many points of view. I would just encourage you to read the information on the EPA's website if you're interested at all in knowing what their goals are. And then I just caution everyone that there's a lot of rhetoric out there on what the definitions, what their regulatory approach is going to accomplish. My personal view is that it's been long overdue that they define in a rule waters of the U.S., and I think it's needed because of the various interpretations. And I'll get back to you in just a second, Dr. Foley. Before that, I wanted to mention that also at the ECOS meeting, it was announced that the EPA's deadline for submitting comments on 111D would be extended, and I'm sure David Thornton will talk about that when he talks about the Clean Power Plan rule today. So that was some of the events, and Janet McCabe, the Assistant Administrator for Air, spent a full four-hour session talking with us about clean air and the proposed regulation. So significant interest across the states in that regulation. Dr. Foley.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, as a subchapter to that, did they talk about the navigable waters issue? relative to waters of the United States?
I don't know if the rule characterizes navigable waters. Navigable waters is a term of art that's used by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in their regulatory programs, either under Section 404 of the Clean Water Act or under Section 10 of the Rivers and Harbors Act of 1899, I think it is. Is that right? 1899? Geez, I still got that back there someplace. So navigable waters and public waters and waters of the U.S., all these terms of regulatory art, they get tricky. So a good share of my previous life was spent explaining that to people. Now I'm out of practice, so I'm going to stop there. Mr. Riddle.
Yeah, thank you. It's my understanding that the U.S. Congress has passed a bill calling on EPA to withdraw that waters of the U.S., but the Senate is not likely to take it up. So does that action of Congress have any bearing on the process, or would it take both houses to?
I think the EPA's response to that question was that they take it as an expression of concern by Congress that there are concerns about the rule, and they asked, at least their response, as I recall it, was we plan to work with members of Congress that authored that resolution to try to explain the purpose of the rule and answer their questions, and if additional time and additional public comment period would be helpful, they'll consider doing that, but they're not considering withdrawing the rule at this time. So I don't know what – I'm not clear on what Congress or the authority of Congress is to restrict rulemaking by the EPA. So at this point, though, they're saying they're going to work with Congress and try to address their concerns. Last thing I'll mention in my report is that we're currently going through our annual rewards and recognition process of our employees, and we are going to be traveling around the state to various of our facilities, and Deputy Commissioner Beeman can let you know where and when we're going to be places in case any of you would like to ever come to those events and just see what they're like and meet some more of our staff that work across the state. We'll be in Detroit Lakes and Brainerd and Rochester and Duluth, Marshall and Mankato. So when they're coming up fairly quickly, so I apologize for short notice, but it just occurred to me this morning that you might like to hear a little bit from our presentations and also meet some more of our staff if you're ever so inclined to be around for any of those events. We'll make you aware of those. And that's my report. Let's move on to items by board members. Any items from board members? Mr. Riddle.
Thank you. Three items, one directly related to MPCA and two just items of interest. First, I see that a large confinement dairy in Winona County had tried to get a variance from the county, but they're proposing to double the size of their herd to almost 5,000 animal units. And that's going to come before the PCA because an EAW is required. So just look forward to the outcomes of that analysis. And unrelated to PCA activities, just want to let you know that two things. Joyce and I have about 5 kilowatts of solar power, a grid intertie with Tri-County Electric, and our home is going to be part of a Midwest Renewable Energy Association tour on October 4th. So just the open house of whoever stops by, I think between 10 and 2 that day. And then also we were on stage about a month ago at the Minnesota State Fair as part of the Farmers Union Minnesota Cooks, where they pair restaurants with farmers and get to be upstage on stage and give reaction to the tastes of things, and it was a lot of fun. But we're on a calendar, so I have some copies here if that's all right, if people are interested. So you can take one. We're actually the January pinup. So you see Joyce and I walking down the row holding hands just like we do every day on our farm.
Wow.
But it's a really nice event that the Farmers Union puts on, highlighting local producers and restaurants that serve Minnesota-grown food. So there's recipes throughout, and just thought I'd bring a few of those to share. And I have a few more in the bag if people in the audience would like some. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you. Any other items from board members? Dr. Sampson.
Good morning. Thank you, Commissioner. I just had wanted to point out that the mercury in the St. Louis watershed made the news again recently, and wanted to maybe just open that up and see if you wanted to talk a little bit about what staff is doing to reach out and kind of answer some of the questions that were posed by the environmental groups in particular.
So. Sure. Shannon Lotthammer is here, and I'm actually going to just ask Shannon to come up and explain a little bit. Last week on Thursday night, there was a citizens forum. It was so-called by the organizers of the event, Minnesota Environmental Partnership, and other non-governmental organizations took the lead in organizing that, and it was about mercury in the St. Louis River, and Shannon was able to go to the meeting for its entirety and present a variety of sort of newsy items from the PCA's point of view. So, Shannon, why don't you just describe that a little bit and talk about the rule and the forum and all those other, if you wouldn't mind. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. I'm Shannon Lotthammer, the director of the Environmental Analysis and Outcomes Division. And so on Thursday, the forum that MEP held was a citizens forum. It started with an open house for about an hour. We had some displays there. We can send a PDF of the display that we had if you're interested in receiving that. And it was myself and then Bruce Munson, who's our lead research scientist that's working on understanding, in particular, mercury accumulation in fish. So Bruce and I were able to interact with the citizens and interested parties that were there, answer their questions about the work that we're doing. Then there was a formal part of the evening that involved kind of a science panel talking about where mercury comes from, the concern about mercury in fish, and then its effect on humans, particularly pregnant women and infants and children. And then some discussion about factors that can affect mercury, including sulfate. And then there was a policy panel, and I participated in the policy panel. There was a manager from the Region 5 of the Environmental Protection Agency that was there, two staff people from the state of Wisconsin that are working on mercury efforts in the St. Louis River and elsewhere, and then Nancy Schultz, who is the water program manager for the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. And we answered questions about or spoke to what are the different things that our various agencies are doing to address mercury, and then what are things that citizens can do, and we responded to questions as well. From the Pollution Control Agency's perspective, what I talked about and the information that we provided was the work that we're doing to continue to implement the statewide mercury TMDL. So back in the early to mid-2000s, the state adopted a plan to reduce mercury from emissions and discharges in the state by 93%. And the goal for achieving that is by 2025. We're actually currently ahead of the pace needed to do that. We're actually, when we look at the large coal-fired power plants, the electrical generating utilities, they will actually have a 95% reduction in mercury emissions by 2016. And that was in large part due to actually a state law that was passed back in 2006 and then the ongoing implementation of that. We also spoke to the questions that have been raised about the drivers of mercury accumulation in fish, because we know from our statewide mercury TMDL work that just reducing the mercury inputs, which, as significant as it is, for about 10% of our water bodies, we will still have a mercury problem even when both the state of Minnesota and the other sources of mercury, both nationally and globally, are reduced even by 93%. And the drivers of that are both the methylation of mercury, so the way that mercury is converted into the form that actually accumulates in fish, and then also the way that the mercury accumulates up in the food chain. And we know that there are a number of factors that play into how that occurs. Mercury methylation is affected by water levels. It's affected by organic carbon, it's affected by sulfate. Those are all constituents that play a role. But what's controlling that and what are the key drivers is still not well understood in the scientific literature. And then also how the mercury actually accumulates. One of the interesting things that we've seen is that those water bodies that have higher mercury concentrations in fish tend to be the water bodies that are more pristine. So one of the hypotheses is that because there's less nutrients in the system and the food chain is less complex and there's not as much algae and small animals and then fish, that maybe that's one of the things that's resulting in the mercury being at a higher concentration because there's fewer organisms to concentrate it into. These are all things that require some additional investigation before we have a good scientific underpinning for what next steps can be taken. Actually, the PCA was successful in the last legislative session in receiving $743,000 in funding from the Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources to investigate those drivers of mercury in mercury bioaccumulation in fish. Bruce Munson is our lead scientist on that work. And then we're seeking additional funding to do some additional watershed monitoring in five rivers that are experiencing this phenomenon. So while it's certainly an issue in the St. Louis River, actually our highest mercury fish concentrations are in the Red River of the North. We're seeing similar issues in the Vermilion River, the Roseau River, and the Kettle River as well. So while some folks really believe strongly that the driver is sulfate and that it's about sulfate coming from things like mining facilities and wastewater treatment facilities, they're just, from our scientific understanding, there just isn't a scientific basis to support that as the key driver. But we're looking into that. We need to collect additional data and information, and we're actively doing that. And that work, the funding was provided this past legislative session. The work will start in earnest this next spring. And we're continuing also to work with partners in the St. Louis River Basin, both the Fond du Lac Band and the state of Wisconsin and EPA, to look at what types of information gaps we have and how we're filling those gaps. EPA is hopefully going to be providing some funding to the state of Wisconsin to do some work in the St. Louis River estuary. So we're piecing together all of these projects in order to really better understand what's happening. And at the same time, we're acting on the information that we have, which is the key thing that we know is we need to drive the mercury down. We need to reduce emissions in Minnesota. We need to encourage reductions in the nation and also national or internationally in order to ultimately solve this problem for all of Minnesota's waters, but also for the St. Louis River. So that's really the information that we provided and shared and then responded to questions. And there was a citizens forum then at the end of the meeting, and I believe that the Minnesota Environmental Partnership will be compiling that information that was shared and providing that to the agencies and all the interested parties that are involved. So we'll continue to share information and to work with stakeholders and get the word out. It was a great opportunity, really, to let people know what it is that we are doing and to point out that we haven't walked away from this problem. We're aggressively working to address both mercury and then to understand the other factors so we can see what next steps or additional steps might be needed.
Thank you, Ms. Lotthammer. Did you have any follow-up on that, Dr. Sampson? Additionally, the agency just the rule was just finally published, and Shannon, I don't know if you want to say a little bit about that. It
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As one of the elements of the implementation plan that was put together in order to achieve that 93% reduction in mercury involved issuing an air quality rule, so putting together a rulemaking that requires additional reporting about mercury emissions from facilities that aren't required under other rules and requirements to report. And then it also requires taconite facilities to, by 2018, develop a plan for reducing their mercury emissions and submit that plan to the PCA so we can evaluate that and then continue to move forward with the steps needed to achieve that 93% reduction by 2025. For the taconite facilities, unlike for the electrical generating facilities, the technology isn't as well known. It's a little more in development. And so that's why that plan is needed by 2018 to determine what are the technologies that are going to work and evaluate those technologies and then implement them again to get to that goal by 2025.
Great. Thank you. Dr. Foley.
Mr. Chairman, I think for me, one of the important pieces of information in both of these discussions was that the agency speaks when it understands, as opposed to reacting short-term or to emotion, that we really need to know what we're doing when we're speaking and formulating rules that will then be in place going forward. It's very easy to react to mercury because it's a very bad actor and does a lot of things to children, and we want to do as much as we can. But short-term fixes to a long-term problem don't generally work. One of the issues that happens as we discuss biomagnification of mercury in fish is people stop eating fish. And, of course, it's a very important part of people's diet. There are very vulnerable populations who depend more on fish in their diet just because of its availability. You know, the Hmong population in St. Paul, they come from a tradition of fishing, farming, and agriculture. And so they have a large proportion of their diet is fish that they locally catch. Having them informed and having the vulnerable portion of that, meaning pregnant women, understanding what water bodies they're getting their fish from is very important. But for the agency not to inflame the situation by, when we speak, not having the basis of sound science. And so it was good for me to hear that in those public fora, that's what we're doing. Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. Foley. And Pat McCann from the Health Department, if you're watching this webcast, you can send a shout-out to Dr. Foley for sending the public health message about eating a healthy diet. It was also part of my history when I worked at the Health Department, was making sure that we didn't sound alarms and result, as you said, in sort of inappropriate response from people. So thanks for that word, Dr. Foley. Any other items from board members? Dr. Foley.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think this week the UN is coming out with, or has come out with, a big report, Economy and Climate Change, mm-hmm. that Felipe Calderon, the president of, former president of Mexico, was the chair on. I'm wondering if the staff will be analyzing that particular report, because I think it's going to have a lot. I've got to get a copy of it myself, but from what I've read, it seems to have a lot of meat in it related to economy, energy, and what's known on climate change. So maybe you have it in your hand there.
Actually, Dr. Foley, I have the state's report on Minnesota and climate change, dealing with Minnesota's economic opportunities relative to a changing climate. And this was prepared by staff from many agencies through the Environmental Quality Board. And this report, along with the one you're describing, really will be part of the discussion of the Environmental Quality Board's efforts to recommend certain strategies for the state to position ourselves to address what economic impacts climate change will have, as well as the opportunities that a changing climate brings. Obviously, we know there are certain resiliency and infrastructure challenges in our changing climate scenarios. There is also some economic factors when you look at how our climate will change and how we might position Minnesota to do well in terms of renewable energy options and other other sorts of drivers of economic growth and change that could benefit the state. So we'll be talking about that. David Thornton is our lead point of contact when it comes to that effort. So if you want to see David back there, and David will make sure that we get a copy of the UN report and also bring that to the EQB discussion as well. He's been working with stakeholders actively on this subject. Thank you. Any other items from board members? Seeing none, we'll move on to our information items. We've got two today, Clean Water Roadmap, and I'd like to welcome Rebecca Flood and Assistant Commissioner here at the PCA, and then John Jashke, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources. And John, I don't know that you've ever actually had the chance to appear before the board. John and I are friends and professional colleagues from back in our days and younger days at DNR, both a couple of hydros, so if I slip and fail to use your proper title, I'll chastise myself right now. So with that, Ms. Flood.
Mr. Chair and members of the board, my name is Rebecca Flood. I'm Assistant Commissioner for Water Policy here at the PCA, and with me is Executive Director John Jashke with the Board of Water and Solar Resources. And we're really pleased to return to present the final roadmap to you. We were here initially in November of last year to present some high-level concepts to you about what we were envisioning for the roadmap. In June of 2013, the three agency commissioners, Commissioner Stein, Commissioner Landwehr, and Executive Director Jashke, requested and charged the Clean Water Fund Interagency Coordination Team with developing a roadmap whose purpose is to chart the course for what we're going to see as a result of 25 years worth of constitutional amendment funding and to establish a pace of progress for that. Our Clean Water Interagency Team is made up of the agencies that you see on the bottom of the slide here, the some executive management from each one of those agencies. And I'd like to ask Director Jashke if he would provide a high-level overview of what the roadmap is, and then I'll move into some specific measures that we've developed as a part of the roadmap. So, John?
Thank you. Mr. Jashke.
Good morning, Commissioner and members. Appreciate the opportunity to be here, and Commissioner Stein came to the Bowser Board meeting, maybe it was a year ago now, as Rebecca described, when we talked about what this was going to be and how it might work. As she indicated, there are a number of us agencies working in partnership on this, as we are on all other such things related to water quality issues. I want to also acknowledge Environmental Initiative, because they were brought on board to help all of us work together and really also brought in the stakeholder process. It was really important to this effort to make sure that not only agency interests and ideas and insights were brought in, but also those of the interest groups, and a wide variety of them, of course, in this area. So, Mike Carley, I know with the eyes in the back of my head, I can tell you're here. So you can wave your hand and introduce yourself to the board members, although I'm sure you're here probably more often than I am. But that was very helpful. Before I go on to the script, I want to do a little off-script backgrounding. There are, you know, intervals, I guess, where we look back and we can see things have been done and they made a difference, and we don't know yet if this is something that will fit into that category. We've got to wait and see, but we're making the attempt here to, you know, shape the future, really, what it's all about. And so I wanted to go back 10 years and then work our way up to now, because the roadmap sort of begins now, but it doesn't mean that nothing has happened prior that's related to it. So, you know, going back about 10 years, plus or minus a year or two. The state was asked, directed, expected, maybe is a better way to describe it, by the EPA to undertake this water quality assessment, and the acronym of a TMDL became known not only to the agencies but to the public, at least some of them, more than we probably thought at the time, because that terminology carried into the way we described what we were doing in the clean water improvement area. And that federal, you know, recipe, I call it, was helpful because it provided a structure. It also provided some additional funding, at least in a temporary way, to get going on that. And I'll come back to that a little bit more because I think we can see that things have evolved from even that time ago and now 10 years that seems so recent in some ways but so distant in others. And then, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, going on six, I guess, you know, we had the constitutional amendment that was voted on and passed, and that, you know, really provided, you know, not only the resources, but it also raised the expectations about what we were going to do, how quickly we could do it. Everyone's got a different idea about that, as I'm sure you've all heard. Some think that, you know, we're going too quickly. Some think that we'll never get there. And the roadmap, I think, is one of those ways for us to build a mechanism to have that conversation and evolve those ideas going forward. And then a couple of years ago, maybe two or three, we started to see the federal recipe wasn't going to be good enough for us in Minnesota. And a couple of reasons for that. You know, the TMDL process really is set up to keep doing it over and over. Each parameter, every time you find a new pollutant, well, we got to start over again on this river or this lake or this watershed. So we ended up doing, you know, multiples of those things. Now they're all a little bit unique, but there's a lot of commonality too. And so it seemed like we were, you know, going slower than we could if we were to do it more comprehensively. So, and this is where I give a lot of credit to the MPCA, because they could have just followed the EPA recipe and, you know, things would have worked, but they found a way to make these things work better for Minnesota. Another deficiency, using that word kindly, with the TMDL approach was that it really didn't do much from a non-point perspective, because it really, you know, lumped all of the point sources, but then left this big blob of sort of a number that, you know, you could throw in there as a non-point component, but it didn't have any mechanism to carry that forward. And because that report, that formula, that calculation was, you know, to be reviewed and approved by EPA, the ownership of it was quite distant and terribly unconnected to what was going to have to happen next. And so one of the other really important parts that has happened in the last few years is that MPCA and others have worked towards a mechanism for Minnesota to make the most use of this really, you know, detailed and quality science that we have invested in. Because if we have all that and send it to EPA for them to say yes or no, it seems like we're underutilizing the resources that we put into that product. And having products that work for Minnesota was another change at the MPCA commission in the last couple of years, and I want to tell you how important that is, because using that science is so critical, because local governments, who are our primary land use authorities in the state and actually all over the country, they can appreciate that, but they have to have it come to them in a useful way. If you just throw a computer model on the desk and say, here's all the answers, it's not terribly helpful to build that local ownership and then the local commitment to funding and action that it really has to follow to make sure we're making improvements. And finally, of course, the EPA recipe didn't account for protection or trends. It simply said, once you got a water that's past a tipping point and beneath a standard, well, then we got to deal with it. But if it's above the standard but, you know, declining, well, there wasn't a mechanism to take care of it. And similarly, if there was a high-quality water that was facing a threat, it didn't have a mechanism to deal with that either. And so we've been able to take the EPA model and turn it into something much more useful and much more comprehensive for Minnesota water quality purposes. And so I want to thank you for the investment in that, because it isn't easy to just change something someone told you to do and make it better. And I think I haven't heard from EPA that they said it was better, but I know they think it is too. But they don't have to worry about it. We here in Minnesota have to take the ownership of these products and make them, you know, make a difference on the ground. So that's where our agency comes into it, because we, you know, take the identification of the problems and the quantification of those and have to figure out how to solve those problems on the ground when it comes to the non-point issues. So we're hopeful the roadmap's going to help with that as well, but it's going to be a much higher level document than the reports, the analysis that's being done on a watershed by watershed basis. So with that, I will get back to the script.
John, if I can just thanks for that, because it is a good summary of sort of the process that got us to where we are, and sometimes we just keep going. You know, we just sort of put one foot in front of the other, keep trying to do better, and it's helpful to hear that. I also want to thank you for, I think you and I rode up to Bemidji one day to go talk to a bunch of local zoning administrators 3 years ago now, and we had the conversation in the vehicle for that 3.5 hours that it takes to drive from the cities to Bemidji, and talked about we do have to find a way to work more collaboratively between local governments that implement action on the ground to improve water quality, protect water quality, and the agency that's doing its work to characterize water quality. And so I'm really appreciate your summary of the history, and also want to thank you for your interest in moving forward and not you're just a great team player. The cooperation is very much appreciated. Thank you.
Well, now the next 10 years, and we'll see how, you know. you know, and that is the challenge. You know, we never get to rest easy, right? You always got to look forward to what's ahead, and that's what, you know, the leadership of your board and your staff are about, too. So with the idea on the roadmap, as Rebecca characterized it, you know, it's about giving us some sense of trying to chart a course for the future, you know, not lake by lake, river by river, or watershed by watershed, but on a comprehensive basis, doing that for water quality in Minnesota going forward for, you know, increments of 5 years, and really looking to the end point, although we hope at some point it's going to be renewed, of the constitutional amendment and the Clean Water Fund that's a component of that. So what we're going to talk about today is a little bit about why we're doing it, what we did, and Rebecca will go into the detailed aspects of the actual goals that we set about to chart the future as a measure of progress. And this diagram, you know, gives a sense of what the purpose of it is or could be. Now, we haven't got to the stage of actually using it yet, but we've built this thing that we believe can be useful. And I don't know if this is an exact way to characterize it, but in some ways it becomes a business plan with measures along the way for how we're doing in achieving a global clean water goal for Minnesota. Clearly, each of these things has to be looked at, you know, much more locally at each, you know, water resource we care about. But on a statewide basis, if we build a good business plan, then those individual water bodies and the expenditure of resources to improve them ought to be done better than it would without some overarching guidepost. How is this going to be useful? The agencies, I think, probably have a head start because, of course, you build a tool and you're probably going to use it yourself as the first customer of your own tool. And this is one of those that I think will fit into our future efforts on planning, on budgeting, on program coordination, that those business plan elements that I just talked about. I think it's going to be important, you know, as Rebecca described, that this thing be something that we use, and that if we use it, we adapt it to current circumstances. And so there are ways to keep stakeholders involved in this. We haven't got all of those details charted yet. As I mentioned, the Environmental Initiative was very helpful in getting the stakeholder interest to participate in building the thing. And they had a lot of questions, to be honest. You know, they said, what's this about? What's it for? You know, why should I care? You know, really honest questions that we were challenged to try and give a good response to. I think the agencies, you know, will have an opportunity to use this when we coordinate our budgeting processes. You know, typically we, like everyone else, are in an annual or biannual budgeting cycle. I believe this will help us look further ahead so that we're anticipating what's going to happen, you know, 4, 6, 8, 10 years ahead, so we can build a plan to address that and be ready when it comes, instead of having to, you know, assemble a budget that looks like a bunch of parts and not knowing what the machine is that it's going to be used to assemble. So that, I think, will be something that agencies will commit to immediately. The other stakeholders, to be determined, I would say, is the answer to that. We believe local governments will be a stakeholder and a user to some extent, probably giving the agencies, you know, their insights and ideas about how we ought to build a business plan that'll work for them as well, or at least a business plan that's got enough of the broad parameters outlined so they can build their watershed plans and things like that beneath it, which gives them some predictability for the future. And finally, I just want to emphasize that even though the Clean Water Fund, of course, is a big, big part of this, it doesn't say Clean Water Fund Roadmap, it's Clean Water Roadmap, because there's a whole lot of other funding, activity, mechanisms to achieve clean water, and all of those would be at some point considered under this project. Let me talk a little about scale, and I kind of hinted at it already. The roadmap is a very high-level, as Rebecca mentioned right at the beginning, endeavor to look at the whole state across all water quality parameters and all waters and all types of factors that influence them. I mentioned a little, too, you know, that as we get more specific towards actions, you know, and more specific in terms of geography and places where you need to see clean water or preserve it if you already have it, we get further down this pyramid. I mentioned in the second level of this pyramid from the top that we do have, you know, the ability to influence our state spending and the actions that the spending is for as part of this. I think that will be probably its first use, and I do believe it'll likely, you know, the roadmap will influence these other components probably in the order they're on this pyramid. We'll see, but that's my prediction. The third level down on this pyramid is about these strategies that are the integration of the science, the monitoring and analysis to tell us what the problems are and where they are and to quantify those. And then the last, if you look at this pyramid at the bottom, the biggest amount of effort but I think probably when you think about it, either first or last, because these things are already happening, the local water plans, the local governments who are responsible for land use and project implementation are going to be the ones that'll turn this into action probably most directly and at the most local or watershed level. It's also going to be important to assess the progress. The roadmap won't assess the progress. The roadmap simply lays out some goals, and Rebecca's going to cover those in just a minute. And so we have to have a mechanism or mechanisms to evaluate progress against those goals. And one of the examples, probably the key example right now, is going to be the performance report that the agencies do as a joint exercise. Is that every 2 years, Rebecca? Yeah, every 2 years to track not only weather and water has gotten over the tipping point or fallen below it, but to look at trends to see, you know, where we're headed in terms of making progress towards a water quality standard, if you're thinking about a particular water resource, or more collectively, you know, how those add up across the entire state or across an entire basin. I'm already ahead of myself here, but we did have a plan in place for the evaluation. The idea is that we will, you know, make revisions to the roadmap about once every 5 years. That seems about right to track progress towards these broad statewide goals with, you know, an interagency review in between those five-year increments. And we have already in place an interagency coordination team that does this basically, you know, I would say once every month or so, maybe more often when they have to meet to try and both project programming for these for the clean water initiatives as well as evaluate progress. And then, you know, I talked about getting to this point of having this document and, you know, the process that we used Environmental Initiative to help us with. This was probably the most difficult part, which was to come up with goals that are real and ambitious, but yet realistic. And there's a broad spectrum of what people think. We did some poll. You know, you sit in the room with a clicker and do this instant polling, you know, and we had people that thought we were going to have all of our waters cleaned up, you know, in 20 years. And we had people that thought we were going to be 1% of the way towards that numerical goal. And we're somewhere between there, in case you're wondering. But Rebecca's going to give you the best we have for the time being. But it is important to challenge ourselves to be ambitious, but not to be so ambitious that, you know, it becomes unrealistic and people discount it because it's over the top. And we also recognize that it isn't just the numbers. It isn't just the chemistry that you measure in a stream or a lake or some other water body. There are important other factors that need to be brought into this. You know, we have to make judgments, set priorities. You know, human health aspects of a water quality problem may have to outweigh a biological problem that doesn't affect human health. If we looked at just the numbers, we'd say, you know, take care of the sediment. If we say look at the human health factors, we have to look at the bacteria, right? Those are judgments that have to be made case by case. The ecological value, again, you know, we can do some projects or practices by simply, you know, using engineering or even bioengineering mechanisms to accomplish that. We might forego, though, some habitat value that we could get if we supplemented that project with native plants instead of, you know, a generic set of plants that doesn't have that same habitat value. And finally, we have to look at cost effectiveness, right? I mean, we'll never be able to do everything that people can expect us to do. And so there's different means to evaluate cost effectiveness, but it's a real world consideration in just about everything we do. And then finally, there are some things that we don't get to control, but we still have to acknowledge external factors. And, you know, these have been brought to our attention previously. I'm sure yours as well. You know, climate adaptation, the changes there are going to be important to consider. Land use decisions that are made by others are going to be something we have to deal with if they're not in some way, other way, managed, because most of the problems we have with our water quality are derived from private land. It's just absolutely clear in any data set you look at that it isn't our public lands that are giving our water quality challenges to us. It's the water coming off of the private land, and private land is you know, a different set of circumstances. We've got to talk people into doing things, you know, because we don't have regulations that make everybody do things that we believe could fix the problem, and you can't use regulation as a tool in most cases anyway because it just isn't practical or too expensive. So those things are realities we got to deal with. There's some hopeful things too. I mean, like technology can help us with some of our chemistry problems, particularly things like nitrogen, where you can see a future where they can find ways to have these products be more environmentally friendly there and more efficient as well. I'd like to think that in 5 years we'll have a better product on the market that people will be able to buy and use that will cause less leaching and so forth and provide more of the production value that it's intended to. We also have some challenges too. You know, we have in the rural area, we have a big federal program called the Conservation Reserve Program, or CRP, which is, you know, going to have 700,000 acres of grassland in Minnesota be expiring for temporary contracts. And so we've got to figure out how to keep the best of that for our water quality purposes. So the roadmap will help us incrementally assess, evaluate, and project our future. And I'm going to turn it over to Rebecca to cover some of the details. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, John. So we really have innumerable measures that we could pick from. John referenced the Clean Water Fund biennial performance report. There are 30-some measures in that, kind of undergirded by several hundred measures that get rolled up into that 30. So it was initially quite a challenge to try to pick something simple, four measures that would reflect what Minnesotans told us was important to them. Can we swim in the water? Is water good for fish and aquatic organisms and bugs? Do we have groundwater of good quality? And is there enough groundwater for sustaining us out into the future? Those are the four things that we decided to select based on values that Minnesotans told us were important to them and that we tried to reflect in this roadmap. So on a high level, the interagency coordination team was really asked to predict the future. And so this is a chart that is not populated by real data, just to say that out loud. So it's conceptual in its nature, but we want to use it here to try to illustrate the point of what we think the pace of progress is going to be over the course of 25 years of investing in both establishing the framework, as John referenced, our monitoring and assessment and watershed restoration and protection strategy development, that watershed approach is there, and also just to recognize the fact that as we take actions on the ground to address different sources of pollution, whether that be from industrial or municipal facilities, from urban stormwater or agricultural non-point source, that there's a lag time that we see from the time that we take that action to a response within a water body. Generally speaking, those problems are now much more diffuse and will take us longer to get to. So what we anticipate here in the longer term is that we'll see a gradual increase in response in the actual measurements that we take within water quality over the course of 25 years. So that's what we anticipate, what we expect to see. Individual water bodies may certainly respond differently, but across the whole state, because of the innumerable actions that we have to take in our land of more than 10,000 lakes and nearly 100,000 miles of rivers and streams, it's going to take a while for us to actually see statewide improvements in water quality and attainment of those water quality standards. Individually now, I'd like to present to you the four different measures that we've developed. The first regarding lake water quality. Here we're using a trophic status index, which is basically, our communications director, Dave Verhasselt, would love me to say, you know, kind of our green slime index here. So how swimmable are our lakes? How much total phosphorus, total chlorophyll A, and what's the clarity, the transparency of our water bodies? We've divided the state up in these measures into the nine major basins around the state, and while we've projected improvements within each basin, statewide we expect to see an improvement going from waters that don't meet water quality standards for our TSI into meeting water quality standards. We expect over 25 years to see an improvement statewide of 8%. Now, I know that can initially be shocking to some people. Again, as John mentioned, I think some of our citizens expected that we would see, you know, all water bodies cleaned up and restored within the 25-year time frame. But again, with our crystal ball and looking at some of these different factors, the pace of progress that we expect over the course of 25 years to be an improvement statewide of 8%. We'll see from this chart, though, that we're anticipating that while we'll be working in all the major water basins, we do expect that actions taken on the ground will result in progress in every one of the watershed, the major basins. And some basins will improve more than others based on the fact that some water bodies, some lakes may not be as impaired as other lakes throughout the state. We tend to see those that are impaired in the northern reaches of our state to be actually closer to meeting water quality standards, and there's more degradation, for example, in some of the lakes that we see across southern Minnesota. We move to then our rivers and streams water quality measure. We're looking at the indices of biotic integrity for fish across the state. Really, this measure is looking at, do we have the appropriate types of fish in our rivers and streams and of appropriate number that we anticipate should be in either the cold running rivers of the north or the warmer rivers that we see in the southern part of the state. Again, a statewide measure of improvement over the course of the 25-year funding we see at about 7%. So again, some watersheds will improve faster, some basins will improve faster across the state than what we anticipate here. Sure.
you know, one thing you'll see if you look carefully at this map, and it was called out on a number of occasions, you know, if you look at the southeastern part of Minnesota and you see that the goal there is 85% in today's terms and 85% 25 years from now. Right. People say, well, you know, aren't you going to get anything done there? The reality is that it's going to take a lot of work just to stay even at a threshold at 85% of those water bodies, you know, meeting standard. And so the numbers don't indicate a lack of effort. It reflects what we can believe to achieve in using that measure as a status, I guess, of improvement. Holding your own in some places is a very good benchmark to aim for. So that's why I try to point that one out. I know Rebecca has too, that, you know, doing nothing doesn't mean you stay where you are. It takes effort to sustain what you have.
We'll come back. I want to let him finish and then let's come back and I have a conversation about the whole presentation. That's a very good point. Thanks, John.
And certainly, Mr. Chair and board members, as we try to consider in these measures, as Director Jashke was saying, that sometimes holding steady can be good, frustrating and disappointing, although it may be, particularly since here as John pointed out, in the lower Minnesota, holding steady, the Mississippi River Basin drains two-thirds of our state. So while we are taking actions all across the state to address those water quality impairments, it's going to take a lot of concerted action over many, many decades in order for us to achieve water quality standards from a whole variety of different sources that will end up cumulatively resulting in a significant enough reduction in things that affect, in this measure, things that affect fish IBI. It's going to take a lot of work over a long course of time. It took us a long time to get to this particular point, and I think one of the rationales for having at least 25 years worth of funding was a recognition that it is going to take a long-term sustained effort to improve and protect our water resources throughout the state. In terms of groundwater, the first measure for water quality is looking at two measures, drinking water standards both for arsenic and for nitrate. And the goal here for arsenic is to reduce the presence of arsenic in new wells that exceed the standard by 50% at the end of 2034. Now, arsenic is a naturally occurring material in our geology. The best thing that we can do in terms of meeting this particular goal for arsenic is to learn more about where we find arsenic and make sure that those wells for either private residences or public water supplies are located in areas where that avoid that arsenic. And some of the constitutional amendment funding is going for us to have better understanding of that underlying geology so that we can avoid those areas. Now, we also recognize that nitrate in groundwater and drinking water is a significant concern. And our goal there is to reduce nitrate in drinking water by 20% by 2034, particularly in the two known vulnerable aquifer areas, both the southeast region of the state, the karst region, and then the central sands area. And this table shows the progress that we hope to achieve by the end of 25 years in those two particular areas, where our current levels are and what our goals will be moving out into the future in each one of those major groundwater areas. In terms of groundwater quantity, we want our goal there to be 90% of the groundwater monitoring sites affected by groundwater pumping will either have steady water elevation or increasing groundwater elevation trends so that we're not depleting our groundwater aquifers due to pumping by the end of 2034. So we want to reverse that trend and make sure that the work that we're doing is recharging those aquifers to ensure sustainable supply moving out into the future. Now, we don't have, because our monitoring of groundwater elevations throughout the state. We have gotten recent appropriations to the Department of Natural Resources and the Department of Health to actually install more wells across the state so we can get a better understanding of what's happening with groundwater elevations and groundwater quantity through the state. So we don't have a similar chart for this because a lot of those long-term trends, 25 years worth of records that's reflected at least on these wells in this map, we're going to be dramatically expanding our network in order to statewide to better understand our groundwater quantity issues. So in terms of John referenced that we were going to be doing a five-year review, a purposeful review. One of the things that we would like to add to each one of these individual measures in terms of a simple graphic is kind of what we referred to as a stoplight, the red, yellow, green, with each one of those measures. As we do a five-year review, look at our data and information, you know, are we green? Are we on track? Are we headed in the right course in terms of meeting our longer-term goal? Is there some cautions that we may have, some other things we may need to think about, additional data gathering, or is there a red stoplight? Do we need to create a new program, have some new additional things that we may need to do in terms of bending the curve better toward meeting what our goals are in these particular measures? One of the things that Commissioner Stein has pointed out to me and I've used quite frequently now is, you know, we're going to have about $2.5 billion to use over the course of 25 years to protect and restore all the waters of the state of Minnesota. And recently, the Army Corps of Engineers is moving forward on a project to do flood protection around Fargo-Moorhead. The price tag on that project is $1.8 billion for one project. And we have $2.5 billion for all of our water resources for 25 years. So I think what this roadmap tries to do is to create some reasonable expectations. I think going into the constitutional amendment funding, we knew it was never going to be enough money to do everything that needed to be done. But is it going to help us make progress and address issues and try to bring more information and science to bear to our problems and then help guide implementation activities both on by state agencies and local units of government? Absolutely. So we know that we've got a long way to go. We're 5 years into it. I think we've made some really good progress in terms of developing frameworks. Local units of government and others have been implementing all across that time frame. And we hope that this roadmap will provide a good course for us for the future. And I think unless, John, you want to add anything at this point, we're happy to address questions.
Thanks. And thanks to both of you for the presentation. And I know we'll have a number of questions. I wanted to point out a couple of other underlying things for the geeks of us that are, you know, close to all of this, which is you notice that there were no real county lines on any of those maps. Interestingly, it takes a little effort for agencies to all agree on
subtly illustrated county maps.
Yeah, very. So these are all one of the things that's most gratifying to me is to see all the agencies referencing the same thing. That we don't talk about different geography anymore. We talk about watersheds for surface water, and we talk about groundwater provinces for groundwater. That's, you know, in the course of my career, been a long and difficult argument. We've resolved that argument in this conversation. The other thing I just wanted to point out is a quote that Commissioner Landwehr started with from DNR, that part of the challenge of having why have a roadmap is because people don't agree. They actually don't agree on where we're going. They, as John pointed out, some people think we're going to make 1% difference. Some people think we're going to make 100% difference. Now, this is not you can't get the statistics behind all of this because there isn't anything like that. It's an informed judgment of all the interagency teams talking to each other, scientist to scientist, policymaker to policymaker. What do we think a rational goal can be? Not should be, can be. As you mentioned, John, you said, is it achievable? Do we believe it? Can we offer evidence of why we think it's believable? And we did that. So I just think this is one of those, this is not a conversation-ending device. This is actually a conversation-starting device. And so I also wanted to just give a thank you to the Environmental Initiative, to Mike Harley and his staff for their work to engage stakeholders. We had a lot of frustrated people early on. I think now we're starting to hear more questions, and it has helped us frame a conversation, and that's why we brought it here today, is to engage the board in what do you think about this? Where do you see this as having strengths and weaknesses for the discussion of our future? And with that, I know, Mr. Riddle, you had a question. I'll start with you, and others will get to your questions. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, and thanks for your presentation. And I have a number of questions and a few comments, but I certainly support the whole concept of having a roadmap and coordinated actions and plans between all the state agencies and local units of government. The question that I first want to ask has to do with the slide about the river and stream water quality where Southeast Minnesota showed no ability to make progress. that jumped out at me. I appreciate John's comments on that. But two questions I have there. How was that current level of 85% established? And then how does, you know, you said it's going to take resources just to hold steady and keep it at 85, but when a map shows, you know, currently you're at 85, 25 years from now you'll still be at 85, how are funding priorities impacted by those kind of numbers when you look and see other areas with much more need or the ability to achieve the goals?
Rebecca.
If I could try that first and then turn that to John. What I wanted to point out to you on this table is that while we anticipate making progress, because the lower Mississippi drains a substantial part of the state of Minnesota, a lot of things on that whole landscape need to change in order for fish IBI within the Mississippi River itself to be to meet water quality standards. In addition to that, as we look at on the map, the watersheds that drain into the Mississippi River, we are also looking at the type of landscape changes that are happening there, the changes in land uses, the conversion from having lots of grass-based animal agriculture, the impact of climate change, the rolling type of topography. We anticipate that there, for those within that basin, that there'll be more erosive forces that will be happening, and think that that will have an impact on seeing a percentage improvement and attainment of water quality standards for fish IBIs. So that's part of the dynamics that we're trying to anticipate as we make a projection into the future about what we might see in terms of attaining the standard. Mm-hmm. We think that there'll be progress made within individual rivers and streams, but overall within that lower Mississippi River Basin area, we think if we hold steady, that's what we anticipate there.
John.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Riddle, I think that, you know, a couple of things I would offer you. One is that, you know, when you're starting at 85%, you're already high. So, you know, keeping that, as I said, is not something that you just can hope for or count on. It's going to take effort. And I think this will be much more meaningful to projects and practitioners at the watershed scale, you know. So you look at the Cannon or the Zumbro or the Root River. What happens in those rivers is what's going to really matter, and that's where we're going to need to set the priorities and seek the funding to either improve or sustain the high-quality waters we have. And those, pick those three anyway, as the majority of that basin, I guess you want to think of it that way. I don't, at this point, have an answer for how it will influence decision-making on terms of funding. At this point, we've been doing everything on a watershed scale for implementation. This is, as you look back to that pyramid, this is, you know, three levels above that in terms of watershed project decision-making. So this is going to be more about a business plan overall, not about a decision that you'd make on a watershed-by-watershed basis.
And do you know how that, in simple terms, how that current level of 85% was established?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Rule, my recollection is, and I wasn't intimately involved in the amalgamation of these numbers, but remember, we're looking at one indicator. We're looking at this fish-based biologic health as the indicator. Maybe Shannon, are you still here, Shannon?
Yeah.
If there was any more of that? I think we can get back to you on that. But they are, we had to pick an indicator, you know, because there's lots of them. And I believe they were starting with whatever they have for data sets that they've already accumulated, not anticipating, I mean, anticipating there'd be more of that done in the future because the resources to assess and study are still being applied.
If you would roll forward one slide, Rebecca, there's a number of stream sites listed there. So those are existing data sets. Those are places that we have enough data to come forward with a numeric value on that index of biologic integrity from a stream and fisheries health perspective. So it really is an average, I would assume, but Shannon, you might want to clarify that at some point, or Rebecca.
Actually, I think I participated in the development of what these goals are, and basically, as the commissioner said, it's best professional judgment. To rely too heavily on kind of this as a numeric answer for what we anticipate, again, as I said, we're looking at things like climate change and extreme weather events, the type of topography that's located in the area, looking at changes in land use. We're seeing, again, a lot of different land use. We're also looking at charts of information about where projects that the Board of Water and Soil Resources either has funded or has worked with local units of government to fund. So we're also looking at the types of activities that are taking place within those basins. Is it a very active area where there's a lot of watershed work going on? So we've tried to, and then arriving at, do we think there's going to overall be a significant attainment of water quality standards, a significant improvement, or are we, again, holding our own? If you look at something like the Red River Basin, again, because the topography there is not as challenged from rolling hills and slopes as you might see in the southeast part of the state, we're going to see a small improvement in terms of attainment of water quality standards. But we also know that there's a significant amount of agricultural tile drainage that's going into that landscape. So those things are also taken into account as we've tried to make. I guess what I didn't say is you didn't see my crystal ball invisibly sitting here next to us. We're trying to make a projection out into the future about, based on what we're seeing today, looking at the end of a 25-year constitutional amendment period, this is our best professional judgment on what we'll see. So if you can kind of take it in that context.
Sure. The baseline, though, is a straight calculation.
That is correct.
If you look at 310 out of 365. That's the straight calculation. It met, those 310 sites met the acceptable parameters for
fish IBI.
That's how 85% was calculated. Then it's the crystal ball after that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll let other people talk. I'll come back with some other questions. But just I think you can understand my concern that if you're already at the goal, it's a lot harder to access funds compared to, say, the Minnesota River, where there's a chance to improve by 16%.
Yep.
Mr. Chair, if I might say that in terms of strictly applying whether or not Southeast Minnesota is going to get funds based on we're holding steady. I don't think that's necessarily the criteria. That's not going to be the criteria for funding moving forward.
Just one other comment. Thank you, Shannon, for this message. We'll see improvements in some segments, but there will still be components that will not fully meet or attain standards. Therefore, there'll be improvement, but it won't, because IBI is one of those things that sort of aggregates a number of indices. It's an index for a number of individual parameters. It's going to be one of those things that will be challenging to explain, just to your point. But I can recall the conversation that we as leaders had about these indicators. And trophic state of lakes, for example. No one in the public understands what trophic state means, nor do they understand what fish IBI means. But they can relate to lake water quality. And so what's the thing that we could use that would most reflect what people think about when they think about lakes or rivers? That's how we chose these things. So they're art and science, and they're not perfect. I would say there's going to be plenty of conversation about the choices. Dr. Drager, I know you had a question.
Yeah. So it kind of piggybacks on what Jim Riddle said, was when there's huge investments like in southeast Minnesota, like the DMC, a destination medical center, I mean, that has got to have some role in what those, you know, future crystal balls would look like. But, I mean, a huge allocation of resources, hundreds of millions of dollars, and, I mean, can we, any way to take these roadmaps into account, any way to have some water quality or land use protection built into what we're expecting to be a massive buildup in that southeast corner of the state? Just wondering kind of how we're integrating or even connecting the dots among the actions that even our own state government is taking.
Good question.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Drager, I'll try a shot at that. One of the aspects that's going to happen as a part of that urban development that's going to accompany Mayo Clinic's expansion and destination is the fact that we have a municipal stormwater permit that will need to be complied with. And one of the elements of that I think will dramatically impact the quality of stormwater runoff in that area is the fact that our MS4 permit requires infiltration of stormwater, the first 1 inch of stormwater, which will dramatically, I think, affect the quality of the runoff from those types of urban areas. You also have to take into account the fact, if you think about size and scale, it's a big project, but it's a very small amount of land area that they're going to be impacting. So hopefully in this particular case, in this example, some other controls will come into place that is kind of a couple levels down from this overall goal in the roadmap.
Dr. Drager, you're raising a really important point about state allocations of resources. And the EQB has had some conversation about how the state allocates its resources from an environmental and sustainable future perspective. And so this, my take on responding to your question is this gives us a foot in that door. At least we can offer a perspective now that if you're going to invest a significant chunk of money in roads, let's say, for example, somewhere in the state, how would we look at investments in roads relative to water outcomes? This might help us have that conversation with the folks that are having a conversation about how do we allocate dollars for transportation. It's not perfect, but it simply allows us to kind of open the conversation. Did you have a follow-up?
I did have a follow-up. So the concerns about the DMC are not just for the city proper, but the counties around the area and the communities around the area are really worried about what the impact is going to be because they're expecting, I mean, it's that ripple effect that's concerning for the entire region. And, you know, that area doesn't have a regional development commission, so they don't have any overall, you know, at least in terms of that level of planning available to them. So this is just one example because we kind of brought up, like, just it is ambitious in that scenario to hold that steady state through the future, but just thinking as, this, like, Commissioner Stein said, as we make these big investments in infrastructure that have these not just city land use effects but outlying land use effects, if we can just try to keep some of these goals in mind as a state, which I know is extremely ambitious. So,
interesting comment. Dr. Foley.
Well, just to piggyback on my colleague, because we get windows into activity in that part of the state by we looked at an ethanol plant a number of years ago. When we looked at the ethanol plant, we also looked at the groundwater drawdown that Rochester does, 1.3 plus billion gallons a year. So you now expand more activity in Rochester. What's the effect or the connections between this activity? The effect of other agriculture, bigger dairies, et cetera, et cetera. So this whole connectedness is, I think it goes back to you have multi-agencies here that allow the state to look at this diverse connectedness and really, I think an analysis like this needs to look at that because you do one thing. You give Mayo Clinic $500 million, and they throw another $500 million in, and then they start building. We got another view into Rochester when we were dealing with the power plant, a 1960-era power plant that burns coal, came in here and asked for an increase of 67,000 tons or 167,000 tons of emissions in order to heat one building, the Gonda building, by adding the steam line. Without, of course, because they're a legacy power plant, they did not have to come under new source standards, which I guess will be part of our next discussion. Just to give you a look at that. So we took a very hard line. What we said to both the Rochester Public Utility and the Mayo Clinic has representatives that sit on that power utility because that's what heats their buildings, that, yes, they could increase it, but they could not increase any of the discharges. So it forced them to take a good hard look at their coal supply, where it was coming from, what were they putting out, and what were some of the things they had to add so they could add the heat but not add the output. And it's part of this connectedness that this agency and a number of others, and I'm glad to see the other agencies that are represented here, needs to take hard looks at, because doing one thing over here forces something over here. And how do we as a state understand that and regulate it? Because we want the Mayo Clinic to be successful. Obviously, we gave them $500 million for a new initiative, and they're very worthy of doing that. But if there's a negative effect that in order to heat the buildings that they're doing, they've got to pump out a lot more air regulated pollutants, that's not probably in our overall interest. And they've got to draw down a lot more water out of an aquifer that's already affected. So looking at that connectedness, I think, is very important, and continuing this kind of multi-agency state initiative, I think, gives us a forum for doing it that way.
Mr. Jensen, and then Dr. Sampson after that.
Commissioner, and I think it relates to what Dr. Foley's stating, but I'm not sure if it's a philosophical question or technical question or what, but I'm you know, first a roadmap, you know, 25 years in the future is ambitious and daunting. And I'm looking around the room and I'm thinking, okay, well, there might be a couple people still here in 25 years. But But, you know, it's going to take a lot of initiative and momentum to keep, you know, the effort going. And so my question is, and we talked about, Mr. Jansky said that, you know, we're not starting today. We've been doing this for 10 years or even longer than that, actually. But we're developing a lot of data and a lot of records. And so my question is, you had a lot of agencies listed up there. Is there a common database that exists somewhere that researchers and participants can access, you know, going into the future? Because that's really what we're talking about is where we're going to be in 25 years. So how is that going to be applied and maintained, I guess? And to get into some of the issues like Dr. Foley was stating, when we come up against one isolated, which appears to be isolated type of initiative, but yet it really isn't connected to a lot of other issues. How do we get that all working together?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Jensen, we actually have several different types of databases. You're right, we're collecting, you know, massive amounts of information based on this constitutional amendment funding, so much more than we ever did. And we've been working to actually combine several different types of databases already, and multiple agencies contribute their data to a database that the Pollution Control Agency houses and maintains. We add our data to it. Department of Health adds theirs. Department of Agriculture adds theirs. And so that we can do a very effective job at sharing among state agencies. What we're looking at currently, and we had funded in the previous biennium, was a water data portal, $2 million appropriation to evaluate whether or not kind of a big portal that everyone comes through, whether that's other state agencies, local units of government, citizens, could come in order to access this information and data. They didn't have to go to a separate database that the PCA had or, you know, Department of Ag had or whatever. You could kind of come through one doorway and then access this information. We're in the process right now in the second year of this biennium, FY15, to actually, we've done a lot of work establishing what would be the data needs and then moving forward kind of a, I think it's almost a if you build it, will they come sort of evaluation. If we have such a portal, who would use it? What's the data requirements? How big and complicated is this to do? And what would be the needs moving forward to in order to make all of this data and information generally available to the public? So we are currently in the process of doing that type of work, strictly looking at the data. It still is going to rely on a lot of interagency coordination to make the links between what does that data tell us and what is happening in a project such as the Mayo Clinic and Destination in Rochester. So there still is, I don't know if there can be a big enough database in the sky to kind of make all of those different connections between what is this data telling you and how do we apply it out in the field. I think it's still going to take kind of running through people filters in order to make those connections about what is the data telling us and how does that then influence us moving forward in different projects. But that's just my editorial.
And we've had a presentation here by Mr. Scuda and our consultants from Management Analysis Division talking about that portal. You might recall that's one of the and this is never a good answer, but a bureaucrat is compelled to give it, which is we're in a much different and more forward-leaning position than we ever have been in the past. Every local unit of government in the state has much more data that they are contributing to the knowledge of our local resources and their community and their developments. It's dramatically explosive, the amount of data that's available now. So really shaping it is the challenge, not so much of even aggregating it. It's just getting people to find the right things. So other question. I had another question from Dr. Sampson.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, and thank you everybody who participated. I imagine this was a cast of thousands sort of thing. I have a lot of technical questions, but I think I'll table those for later.
Let's have coffee.
Time for a burger again or something, right? But I do have a kind of a comment, maybe an admonition, I guess, or a suggestion, and then a question about how Board Member Jensen sort of anticipated my question a little bit here. One is, I think looking around the room, I know that a number of us have been on projects of a similar feel to this, where you're projecting out 25 years in the future or 100 years or whatever. You're creating some great visionary comprehensive plan about water and with a lot of hopes in it, a lot of deep thought about what the state of Minnesota should look like 25 years from now. Unfortunately, I think a lot of those plans, if they were in print form, are collecting dust. If they were in electronic form, they're accessed very rarely. So it's sort of a lot of beautiful, wonderful, exciting work that doesn't always seem to come to fruition. So I guess with that as background, and I don't want to be a downer because I think this is a very hopeful message, but what I guess I have a comment and then a question. The comment is more about how you chose the four goals, and that is going to the idea of group process, where group process sometimes comes up with the right answer and sometimes it gets brought down to an average that is not necessarily the right answer. So I guess my suggestion would be in those reviews that you build in, if it hasn't already been done, build in the question, yes, in this year we established these four things that we're looking at. Are those still the correct and best things to be putting our efforts towards? Recognizing that group process has flaws. So that would be my request or suggestion to you. My question is, you know, this is very ambitious. It is 25 years. You know, it's like I hope to be here physically, but I don't know that I'll be, you know, working actively in water. Who knows? Someone will still be getting whatever form of electronic communication there is from me every now and then as I sit in my rocker somewhere. But I'm not that old. I'll take that back. I won't be in a rocker yet, as long as I don't break my kneecaps again. So anyway, my question is, given this very broad, very ambitious project, given also the individual work that each of the agencies done, you know, we've talked about the St. Louis River this morning, which is obviously a very important thing about water quality in northeastern Minnesota, but isn't contained in this project at all. How do you ensure, what mechanisms exist to ensure not, and I want some language stronger than hope, to ensure that that meaningful work is being made on this plan, on this roadmap, and also that it is adequately balanced with the more, all of the work that on water quality and water quantity that doesn't fall into this roadmap is balanced within each agency as well. So it's sort of a, how do we get all the work done? Big question. So thank you.
Mr. Jaschke is going to take a run at this one.
No. Well, I appreciate the admonition, actually. That I think we need to make sure that we're doing that to ourselves, and we're getting pretty good at that too, so hopefully we'll keep that up. But to your point about how to keep it meaningful, really there's only two things. Keep it in front of people and make it renewed. And you describe, I think, a great idea, which is in 5 years or less, we got to make sure these are the actual variables we want to be measuring, because maybe they either aren't as meaningful as we thought, or there are better ones that could be more meaningful. And the other answer about making it impactful is tied to an energy source, which is money, and use it in a planning fashion to create the business plan and put the money behind the actions that you're going to take. Because if you don't do those things, you're right, they become ideas and they lose their usefulness. If you don't keep it updated and you don't tie it to an energy source, and money's the best one we've got to do that in government, it won't be as useful as it could be. So that's my two thoughts for the time being.
Go ahead, Rebecca.
And Mr. Chair, Dr. Sampson, I would also offer that while you don't see things like St. Louis River and mercury immediately reflected in this. It certainly is a part of our overall conversation as we prepare biennial budgets and look at long-range plans. You're certainly aware that we have a St. Louis River area of concern that we're doing a whole variety of different work on in order to delist those beneficial use impairments that we have. So it's kind of like an agency strategic plan in a way where some employees look at the strategic plan and they go, I don't see myself here, so therefore my work is not valued, or maybe I don't have to do my work, or it's similar in that way. Just because it may not be reflected here immediately as a measure doesn't mean that it's not important work that the agency recognizes and will continue to move forward.
And I'll add one thing that we as commissioners talked and agency leaders talked about. There are really three components. One is this aiming. Planning is aiming. It's not necessarily scientific, but it involves a lot of science. The other thing that, and John did a great point of tying the energy source, is money. There's a huge driver in the incentive to make wise use of available resources. The other is policy, that we have statutory framework in this state that compels us to comply. And so we do have a Clean Water Legacy Act. We have local water planning requirements. We have a variety of other regulatory and statutory responsibilities. So there, while this sort of assumes that all of that is there and isn't going to go away, this is really helping us to think about, so we're going to look at the St. Louis River and we're going to do what we have to do to clean up the area of concern, and we're going to have to meet our mercury and our other TMDL requirements for a variety of other things. That's already there. This is at a higher scale. When we talk to the people of the state, where do they think we're headed? Now, there are very intelligent people who know that we got to deal with mercury in the St. Louis River, but what else are people interested in? What else do they want to know about? That's how these, you know, parameters, these sort of four areas were chosen, is we think that they reflect what we're hearing from citizens. Now, I, too, appreciate the admonition, because we could be completely erroneous on this, and I would readily admit from the health department and from other agencies on groundwater, we don't think that those are necessarily the strongest indicators of water groundwater quality. Quantity, probably we're going to get there, but groundwater quality, we admit we're a little shaky there, and we're hoping for something better. Mr. Riddle. Go ahead.
Just hopefully a one- or two-word answer for this question, and that is thank you. What individual or which agency has ultimate accountability for this roadmap?
All of us.
All of, okay.
None of us have individual accountability.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Sampson, the commissioners have charged the interagency coordination team with maintaining the document, reassessing it, reevaluating it, you know, continuing to convene conversations moving forth into the future, and essentially doing adaptive management as we figure out, are these the right measures? Are we pointed in the right direction? As I mentioned earlier, do we need some additional or change in program in order to continue to bend the curve and make sure that we're on the right trajectory?
Dr. Sampson.
And thank you. And is there a... Should that interagency coordination team cease to exist at some point in the future, is there a succession plan for this map to be carried out? Because I've been in too many projects that don't go anywhere after 2 years, so I'm kind of pushing on the, what's the plan for the future? What's the succession plan for someone to have to be carrying on the torch for work like this?
Mr. Chair, Dr. Sampson, we have been charged with developing what that kind of the next step in this is, to develop that process of, what does a 2-year review mean? What does a 5-year review mean? How do you, what's included in that? What do we consider? How do we, gather different information in order to assess, are we on the right track here? So that's kind of our next charge for our interagency team, and certainly know, what happens with this document should we disappear at some point can certainly be an element of that.
And Dr. Sampson, I know that just from under our current governor, this is what we're expected to do, is manage in sort of a shared responsibility perspective, that we don't isolate each other from the conversation. We actually have that expectation that we're managing. This is a shared resource. Water is, and the governance of water, as you know, is a passion of mine, but I won't go there today. I'll just say that that's our ultimate charge is, and I hope that, as Rebecca said, that the structure that we'll lay out for accountability going forward will be compelling enough that people will not throw it aside. Mr. Riddle.
Yeah, thank you. I heard no mention of pesticide contamination of either ground or surface water, either from agricultural pesticides or urban use, in the roadmap that you presented. And I mean, we know from science that pesticides are related to cancers, birth defects, reproductive problems, autism now is coming out, and certainly pollinators and amphibians, feminization of fish. I mean, human health as well as environmental health. And a report that I mentioned last month's meeting and circulated from the U.S. Geological Survey is now showing neonicotinoids in every stream and river in the Midwest that they're testing. And there's no water quality standard established for this. And same thing for the BT toxins in the genetically engineered corn are being found in the streams and rivers and toxic to caddisfly larvae, amongst other aquatic organisms. And to me, it's a bit of kind of burying our heads in the water, maybe, to not be addressing pesticide contamination of either groundwater or surface water in this kind of a visionary document taking us into the future. So, and it fits the goals, but yet it's not being addressed head on. And, you know, what will it take to name pesticides, name their impacts, and start addressing strategies to reduce their use, reduce the contamination of ground and surface water?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Riddle, I would offer that we absolutely had that conversation as we were talking about what indicators are we going to select. We did talk about mercury. We talked about pesticides, as you were referring to, both in surface and groundwater. And in some ways, particularly with pesticides, those are reflected actually potentially in the fish indices of biotic integrity in one area. It's not specifically called out in terms of what contributes to that in this roadmap, although we know that if those are present, you're not going to get the type of populations of aquatic insects that you may anticipate being present in those types of streams where you are seeing those types of chemicals present. So we thought, again, there's innumerable measures that we could select. We thought that, and again, I think it goes to the fact that we weren't just picking things like total phosphorus or total suspended solids. We were picking indices that represent, in terms of trophic status index and fish IBI, we're looking at things that have multiple things that potentially can impact. So we think those are somewhat represented by the selection of those. We certainly also recognize that those aren't things that we're going to forget in our everyday programs.
Subordinate measures such as that would be useful in terms of the Clean Water Fund performance report discussion, other where we can build the data sets to analyze that information, and it then might become, you know,
it is reflected in that document as well.
I just agree that, you know, we need to keep the dialogue alive about what are the important measures that people want and believe need to be addressed for us to accurately tell the story of trends and results in our water quality. Other, Dr. Foley, did you have another? Okay.
I was just going to make one last point on that point about connectedness. You know, maybe I can come back someday when it makes sense. But we have a, you know, you mentioned there weren't counties drawn on these maps much. And one of the reasons for that is that we're moving in this watershed direction, as Commissioner Stein indicated. And one of the things that we're doing explicitly, if you remember that triangular or that pyramidal diagram in the roadmap being this very high-level document, the greatest amount of action and the utilization of the science moves further down that list or down that pyramid towards the bottom. We are moving in a watershed direction for that connectedness, so that you talk about Rochester and you talk about the areas upstream, and I was just down there last week, and you're absolutely right. I mean, Rochester is a powerful magnet pulling in people and ideas and other things from all around that region. A watershed plan is what we're aiming for. We're going to replace the county-based water planning, which is really the comp plan for how you define your problems, solve them, and find the money to take care of them, to a watershed approach. Some places in the state are further ahead than others. We've got a pilot program underway. I'd like to come back and that's more fully developed and tell you how it's worked, and maybe have a chance to talk about what some ideas are to make it better. So the watershed is becoming our common denominator when both surface and groundwater, different geographies, but a lot of commonality as well.
Mr. Riddle.
Yeah, just on that point, I'm at least for a few more months a local elected official, and we've gone from having in Winona County, one county, one plan. We have about 8 watersheds in the county, with the largest being the Root and the Whitewater, but there are numerous direct tributaries that feed right into the Mississippi. So now we're going from, one county, one plan to one county, two plans for those major watersheds, and then trying to throw in those little ones that may or may not be adequately addressed. But it's at least doubled the staff time for this plan writing. And then you also have to work out, MOUs of whatever form with other counties, with other watershed districts, with other local soil and water conservation districts. It's hugely complex to go from. It sounds simple. I agree with the concept. One watershed, one plan. Looks really good, except when you're overlaying it with all the existing political boundaries and the plan. So, I agree it takes time to get the changes on the ground, but it also takes resources for those units of government to shift gears. And I'm afraid that those resources aren't adequate, and they also, those watershed boundaries are based on surface water flow, not groundwater, which the maps and the flow of water don't match up, and so then the groundwater planning might be inadequate, if the new planning model is just based on watersheds of surface water. So, and I think you recognize that, you'd brought that point up, but we certainly see that in southeast Minnesota.
Thanks.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Riddle, of the 100 reasons why I went out to do it, there's about 51 reasons to do it and 49 not to. And so it's not easy, but I think it does chart the course for the future. And once we work through a number of those things you described, which are how people organize and work, together in a way that they can understand each other and predict what each other is going to do, I think we'll get there. But you're welcome to stay overnight and come to the Bowser Board meeting tomorrow and let them hear what you just said to me, because I'm sure they would appreciate that.
Board members, and Executive Director Bowser Jashke and Assistant Commissioner Flood, thank you very much. Let's.
Thanks for the opportunity.
End our presentation, take about a 10-minute break. Really? Interesting. Go back on the record and just turn to our next information item, board members, on today's agenda, which is somewhere I have an agenda. Well, there it is. Thank you. Needed to borrow one. EPA's proposed clean power plan rule, and our presenters are Assistant Commissioner David Thornton and one of our managers, Frank Kolash. Welcome. please introduce yourselves.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. David Thornton, Assistant Commissioner for Air Policy. I'm going to give a high-level introduction to this, and then Frank is going to do the heavy lifting and walk you through what will ultimately be a fairly high-level overview of the proposal, because this is a very, very complex proposal from EPA to address greenhouse gas emissions from existing fossil fuel power plants. It's referred to as their Clean Power Plan. A couple of you may recall regional haze. Well, this makes regional haze look like tic-tac-toe and tiddlywinks. It's probably the most it's without question the most complex regulation I've ever dealt with in air from EPA, and it might be the most complex one they've ever come up with. And you'll get a flavor for that as we go through this presentation. They proposed it in June. It's over 700 pages long, plus appendices. We still haven't figured parts of it out. And I don't know if we ever will.
Dr. Foley.
When does the comment period end, David?
They just extended the comment period. It ends December the 1st, and thank goodness, because we do need the extra time to sort through some things. Just really high level, you know we have a lot of efforts underway to redress greenhouse gases in Minnesota. For those reasons, we're kind of under the spotlight nationally when it comes to our reaction to this proposal. We're probably the only state outside of the states on the coasts that have taken a positive or have expressed a positive reaction to EPA's proposal in terms of what it's intended to do. We think it's a strong proposal, but it could use some tweaking, and we'll talk about some of the tweaking. We don't have all of that worked out yet, but we're still digging into it. We're not going to meet our state greenhouse gas reduction goals that we've got set for 2015. We're pretty sure about that. But the one area that we have made significant progress in is reducing greenhouse gas emissions from utilities. Because of the renewable energy standard, our energy efficiency efforts, and some of the programs the emission reduction statutes that encouraged our utilities to come in with voluntary emission reduction programs, like the Metropolitan Emission Reduction Plan that Xcel did and Minnesota Power has their own that they've done. But even though we've made some significant progress in the utility sector, the EPA's Clean Power Plan proposal sets fairly aggressive targets for additional reductions here in Minnesota from our utilities. In fact, if you look across the country, our targets are some of the more aggressive. And if you look at some of our neighbors, theirs are not anywhere near as aggressive as ours. As a result of that, many folks have criticized the proposal, saying that it does not give sufficient credit for actions that have already been taken. And Frank will talk a little bit about that as he goes through his presentation. I mentioned that we're still trying to figure out this regulation. We've had numerous conversations with EPA. We've been working with stakeholders. We're maintaining very close communication with the Department of Commerce and the Public Utilities Commission. This proposal takes a big step from pollution regulation towards utility plan management, and that's the PUC's responsibility. So everyone is working closely together here. We're also working with other states in a number of regional conversations, because EPA has, while a state-only response to this proposal is the default, EPA has left open the door for there to be multi-state cooperation in a way that could serve to make implementation of this less expensive. So we're talking to other states about how that might work, if indeed other states might be interested in participating. So with that all said, if some of the things we've been hearing from EPA about our interpretations of the plan are true, then our targets are aggressive, they may very well be reachable by us because of the path that we're already on towards cleaner energy. And we can talk a little bit more about that later. So with that as an introduction, I think I'm going to let Frank go into some of the details. And I know you're going to have questions, and you should feel free to interrupt us because, as I said, it's a pretty complex proposal.
Mr. Kolesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and board members. My name is Frank Kolesch, and I'm manager of the air assessment section for the Pollution Control Agency. And I will attempt to take the delicate balance of giving you an overview without falling into the weeds and providing too much detail on this because it is a very complex rule, and particularly in the sense that the electric generation sector also has a market that sits on top of that for how the electricity gets generated and delivered, which is a complication to the rule about how EPA was doing this, and interstate transfers of power and everything makes it additionally complex. But the context for EPA's proposal is in June of 2013, President Obama announced his climate action plan. It was four primary elements addressed here, which is addressing emissions from power plants and vehicles, increasing electric efficiency, so reducing the amount of electricity that's needed, helping cities and states prepare for climate change, and then being a global leader on climate change and addressing climate change. And this rule is one of the linchpin pieces of the president's plan for the next series of global negotiations in Paris next year as far as establishing some of the binding commitments that the United States is going to be able to provide for greenhouse gas reductions throughout the next decade or so. So this is a very important piece of the administration's climate action plan, and it addresses primarily the first check mark there as far as reducing emissions from the electric generation sector. Also has a touch into the second bullet there, or the second check mark there, as far as reducing the amount of electricity used by consumers, because that is one of the ways that EPA has provided states to comply with what they have proposed in the rule. And before I dive into what the Clean Power Plan rule is actually proposed, I want to take a step back and just put into context, there is another proposed rule that EPA has regarding power plants in the United States that is sometimes referred to as the Section 111B rules, and that is called that because that's the section of the Clean Air Act that it comes from. And this establishes new source performance standards for any new power plant that will be built in the United States. And the way that EPA interprets the act is to say that any power plant built after January 8 of 2014 will have to meet these new source performance standards. And what they really establish are emission rates for coal-fired power plants, oil-fired power plants, and natural gas-fired power plants. For coal-fired power plants, this will mean any new coal-fired power plant will have to have at least partial carbon sequestration attached to that in order to achieve the emission rates that EPA has identified for new sources. And then for natural gas plants, they really have to be very efficient natural gas plants to meet the emission limits that EPA established for the new standards. Now, the rule that we'll be talking about today is, I'm going to try to always call it the Clean Power Plan rule, because it's, while a little hard on the alliteration, it is clean, better than saying 111D, because there are multiple 111Ds. Again, 111D is the part of the Clean Air Act that defines EPA's authority to regulate emissions from existing sources. And it gives EPA a bit more flexibility in dealing with existing sources because it understands that you cannot make an existing source reconfigure or rebuild to the same degree that you can design a brand new plant. What EPA will do under this part of the Clean Air Act and in this rule is establish what are called emission guidelines. And that establishes what EPA expects from the states to do. And then states are responsible for developing a state plan that just demonstrates a state has a program that will achieve equivalent results to what EPA has identified for the emission guidelines. In the preamble to the rule, EPA has identified that they have an overall goal for this rule, which achieves a 30% reduction in carbon emissions from the power sector, power utility sector, from a 2005 baseline. And that is really a back calculation of what they are trying to do. That's what the result is. And you'll see in the next series of slides why I say that that's what their goal comes out to be. It's not exactly the way that they structured the rule by saying that we want a 30% reduction. It's just the result is a 30% reduction in 2030 from a 2005 level. The Clean Power Plan and this part of the Clean Air Act requires EPA to identify something called the best system of emission reductions. And for Minnesota, we are fortunate because we were one of the states that was identified to have a best system of emission reduction. And I'll talk about the number of the state programs that applied to that in the next slide. But Minnesota has been identified in the rule and in other settings as a leader in reducing greenhouse gas and carbon emissions from our power plant and our power utility sector. And also, this part of the Clean Air Act allows states a significant amount of flexibility in building the state plan and building the compliance scenario necessary for states to meet the equivalency test for this part of the Clean Air Act. In Minnesota, the best system of emission reductions, as the EPA identified, really fills out to four state programs, state laws that have been on the books for quite a while. And that includes the Next Generation Energy Act, which in Minnesota establishes greenhouse gas reduction goals for the state. The Renewable Energy Standard, which establishes an amount of generation that utilities must be providing to their customers based on wind or solar or other types of renewable energy that's defined in the statute. An Electric Efficiency Standard, which again identifies utilities have to be achieving a certain amount of electric efficiency on an annual basis that they report to the Department of Commerce. And then two particular emission reduction statutes, which encourage the larger utilities to undertake multi-pollutant reduction strategies, such as the Metropolitan Emission Reduction Program, or MERP, that Xcel Energy or the area plan that Minnesota Power did to either replace, repower, or upgrade the pollution control devices on their fleet. The picture that you see there is the removal of the stack for the coal-fired power plant at the High Bridge plant, which was part of Xcel Energy's MERP plan, and it was just down here on the river that stack was taken down, and that plant was replaced with natural gas combined cycle generation. The benefits of this rule and the costs of this rule have been of particular interest to many, especially those who are concerned about the cost. EPA has estimated that the benefits that will be achieved are on the order of $55 billion to $93 billion per year in 2030, and the costs will be about $7 to $9 billion per year. So the benefits are outweighing by a factor of about somewhere between 7 and 10 times the costs of the plan. And the benefits are primarily coming from two areas. One would be climate mitigation areas, so the reduction in the greenhouse gas emissions from this sector and the models that EPA uses showing that there are potential benefits from mitigating sea level rise, mitigating unexpected weather events, the cost of adaptations to the country or to cities or particular nations to have to deal with the effects of climate change, potential impacts to agriculture, and then potential impacts to temperature and methane generation. As we warm the planet, we run the risk of increasing the methane generation from certain sinks that we have. And then another significant part of the cost or the benefits of this rule are the reductions in ozone and fine particles that will result from these additional changes, as I will say, in our electric generation sector, which will lead to fewer deaths and fewer illnesses due to exposure to ozone and fine particles throughout the country over the timeline of this rule. The structure of the rule, while EPA, if you recall, I said that EPA said in the preamble it's a 30% reduction by 2030 from 2005 levels. That's not how they structured the rule, though. What the rule really structures is taking a 2012 as a baseline that they looked at for the generation, the electric generation, and the carbon emissions from the power sector plan. They started in 2012 and built up from there and then projected out to 2030. The form of what they proposed is a rate-based standard, and that comes out to they're proposing a pounds per megawatt hour as the goals that they establish for states. And then within the plan, they set out an interim goal that states would have to achieve between 2020 and 2029, and then a final goal that states will have to demonstrate that they can achieve by 2030, and then 2030 in perpetuity. EPA, in their rule, established a pathway in which they made their justification that states could achieve their individual state goals. And the EPA did take a slightly different approach on this form of 111D compared to other forms of 111D regulations, that they calculated state-by-state goals for the emission reduction targets and the emission limits that they would establish. It's important to note that the pathway that EPA chose for each individual state is not binding on the state. It is only meant to demonstrate that EPA can show that states have a way that is reasonable and cost-effective in order to achieve the emission limits that they establish. When states write their plans, we have to be able to show that our program will be equivalent to reaching the emission limit goals that EPA calculated for us, and that the state plan will establish the actual each individual state's actual pathway, which will achieve that equivalency in those emission reductions, and eventually the ultimate environmental outcome, which is reduction in carbon. EPA used a novel way to address how to calculate the goals. They broke it out into four building blocks. Again, starting with a 2012 baseline, they looked at what was the coal generation, both on the amount of electricity generated and the emissions that were released from that generation in 2012. To project forward to 2013, then they assumed that across the board, across the nation, all the coal-fired power plants can achieve a 6% efficiency increase going forward by 2030. It's important to note that the effects of the emission reduction statutes that I talked about earlier, in Minnesota, we have actually squeezed some of those efficiencies out of some of our coal-fired power plants already, but that is the way that EPA established that block. Then the next block, they looked at natural gas, and especially natural gas combined cycle generation. And again, as part of Minnesota's emission reduction statutes, we added a significant amount of natural gas combined cycle generation when we replaced Riverside and Highbridge plants with natural gas combined cycle plants, cleaner burning natural gas plants. What EPA did here is looked at nationally that a natural gas power plant should be able to have what they term 70% utilization rate, which means that out of the megawatts that that plant can generate, 70% of the time they can generate that over the year. That's the shorthand. Don't take that to the Department of Commerce as my description, but just to understand the utilization, it can be used significantly more. And so what they did is in applying Block 2 is assumed that natural gas combined cycle plants that existed in 2012 could be ramped up to be used 70% of the time. And for context, Minnesota's natural gas combined cycle utilization was 24% in 2012. So it would be a significant increase in the use of the natural gas. The third building block looked at what EPA would term a zero-emitting generation sources, primarily looking at renewable energy. And what EPA did in this building block was to assign states to a region, and we are in the north central region with Illinois, Iowa, Indiana, Michigan, Minnesota, Missouri, South Dakota, North Dakota, and Wisconsin. And then they looked at what's the renewable energy standard, came up with an average renewable energy goal for the region, and assigned that. In Minnesota, they actually assigned a goal that is 15% renewable energy generation starting in 2020. For context, in 2012, we were already at 18% and were projected to go to above 25% by 2025 because of our renewable energy standard. But that's the way that the EPA calculated renewable energy deployment. They also included a term to address what EPA called at-risk nuclear generation. They just and what they did is put a term in there to try to encourage states to keep nuclear plants that may be economically on the fence for continued use, give states an incentive to try to keep those nuclear plants operating into the future because they are considered zero emission sources. Then the final building block that EPA identified is reducing the need for electricity. It's primarily through electric efficiency, but there are other things that are available in this building block for states to use. What EPA did was assume that somewhere in the decade between 2020 and 2030, all states will be able to reach a 1.5% electric efficiency improvement per year. That's the same as what Minnesota's electric efficiency standard is set up. There may be devils in the detail as a difference between the way our state laws is written and what EPA expects. But what they did do is assume that Minnesota, because we are already moving in that direction, in 2020 we would start with achieving the 1.5% electric efficiency per year. States that are not as far along would have further into the decade, in which they would then ramp up to the 1.5%, but then reaching that. Again, that's their pathway, and that is not what states have to follow, but it established what the final interim and final emission rate goals that EPA established for each state would be. And that's the front end. That is what EPA did for the baseline year and then projecting forward for what states would have to reach. Then there's another significant part of how are states going to be able to demonstrate compliance. And again, there's a significant amount of flexibility built into the way EPA wrote the rule, in that states can write their own program and come up with their own ways to determine compliance, but it does have to eventually demonstrate that we reach EPA's targets, EPA's goals that they've established for us, and we have equivalent programs to get there. The state plans are on a rather aggressive timeline. The president's announcement was that a proposed rule would be released in June of 2014, a final rule released in June of 2015, state plans submitted by June of 2016, and EPA approval within a year thereafter. That continues to be the plan and the schedule. However, EPA did identify that states could seek a one-year extension if they are making reasonable progress on their state plan and they are going that alone as an individual state. And if states are working on multi-state types of plans, then there may be an additional year extension the EPA could provide. But clearly, we will have to be making progress immediately as building this state plan, depending on what kinds of regulatory changes we need at the state to ensure we can demonstrate an equivalent program to what EPA has. So the major issues that we've identified so far with the rule, and David mentioned the first one, Minnesota's target appears to be much more aggressive than other states, and especially other states, neighboring states. And some of the states, what we can see is that where we're seeing some of the differences would be states that made choices to head towards natural gas combined cycle prior to 2012 are really having their rates be more aggressive than states that did not invest in natural gas combined cycle prior to 2012. And also states that are working towards the electric efficiency also seems to be affected there too. It's not clear how EPA addressed early action, and when we have early action in quotes, because that's a term of art in this discussion that means something different to other people and certainly seems to mean something different to EPA than it does to certain stakeholders in the state. But it's not clear how EPA would recognize the fact that Minnesota has been a leader in greenhouse gas emission reductions from the power sector prior to 2012 and how that plays out to the way that they calculated our goal. On a technical detail, Sherco 3, a Sherburne County power plant operated by Xcel Energy, one of the largest coal-fired power plants in the state, was offline in 2012, which was EPA's baseline year. So Minnesota did not have those emissions and that generation included in our calculation. We've submitted comments to EPA on how they should address that, and I believe that the letter was handed out to you. We submitted our first round of technical comments and corrections to data on September 16th. That's the letter you have in front of you. We also needed clarity from EPA on how the rule will accommodate Minnesota's out-of-state renewable energy generation. And that goes to a fair amount of the wind development that counts for Minnesota's renewable energy standard has been built in other states like North Dakota. So Minnesota ratepayers are paying for the wind generation installed in North Dakota, but the turbines physically reside in North Dakota. And how is EPA going to address that and make sure that we get the credit for what Minnesota compelled as far as the build-out of renewable generation in the upper Midwest? We had some questions about how EPA will deal with hydropower, especially new hydropower, as Minnesota Power is looking at the import of hydropower from Manitoba Hydro as one of the ways that they will reduce their dependence on coal going into the next two decades. And then we also want to emphasize what we put in our initial comment letter in December, that Minnesota, while we have the best system of emission reductions, or one of them, as EPA identified, we want this rule to move other states in the same direction that Minnesota has already chosen to go to achieve greenhouse gas reductions and particularly carbon emission reductions from power plants in other states that have not taken as aggressive action as Minnesota has. So the conclusion is that we are pleased with EPA's approach and pleased that EPA is on a national level taking leadership to reduce carbon emissions from the electric generation sector for the country. Because, again, we have been there. We are achieving emission reductions, and we've shown that it can be done. It can be done in a cost-effective way. We're pleased that Minnesota's approach was recognized as a best system of emission reduction, and we want to continue to build on what we have built in the past as far as the coalition and the interest in continuing renewable energy generation, electric efficiency, and cleanest generation of power in Minnesota. We think that this plan, the Clean Power Plan, complements existing policy and other work that's been going on, especially at the Department of Commerce, looking at more renewable energy going on to the system for Minnesota, and that the plan does provide a significant amount of flexibility for states to comply. And we are pleased about that, though it will be challenging because it is a very complex rule, and we will be forging some new territory because of the complexity of what we have to now start to monitor and verify and evaluate for the compliance period. But we think we're up to the task. It will be a very fast timeline, but we are pleased that EPA took the challenge and is heading on that. And then my final points is that we continue to work with the Department of Commerce and the Public Utilities Commission to ensure we understand, analyze and understand how this rule will impact energy planning in Minnesota going into the future. And we have been meeting with stakeholders for the last 2 months to help them understand and hear from them their concerns and their questions and their interests in the Clean Power Plan. And then we will be submitting our comments by December 1st to EPA to make sure that they understand where Minnesota stands as far as this rule and our perspectives. And we are already starting to think about how do we build the stakeholder input process for actually building the state plan that will be necessary for Minnesota to submit our formal document to EPA sometime in 2016. And with that, I will end my comments. I don't know if David has any additional comments he would like to make or if there are questions.
Yeah, just a couple of things. You touched on it at the very end, Frank. EPA is going to finalize this rule late June of 2015. We're virtually certain there will be no slippage of that date because they desperately want to get this done while this administration is in office so that it can't be unraveled. Regardless of who the next administration is, who leads the next administration. We will have 1 year to submit our plan to EPA, which includes any rules or statutes that must be changed. And that's not doable. But I think that if we're well down the path, that should be acceptable to EPA. They've sent some signals that that would be acceptable. We don't know if any statutory changes will be needed. We're virtually certain rule changes are going to be needed in order to implement this. And then finally, we want this to be successful for EPA and the country and for us. We want it to have result in meaningful reductions. Frank went into some of the issues. We're essentially calling them equity issues. The rule as it's proposed tends to require states that have already done a lot and that are already down the path to some degree on transitioning from coal generation to cleaner generation. It tends to require those states to do more than states that have not made much progress in transitioning from coal to cleaner power generation. And while we're not necessarily asking for significant relief from the target that we've been given, we certainly think that some of the other states could be challenged a little bit more to move a little bit further along. And so we'll be looking at whether or not there's some artful comments that we can make along those lines. The comment letter that we sent already was simply to correct some data errors that EPA got, and it really doesn't go into policy at all. We'll be addressing that in whatever comments we file on December the 1st.
Thank you. This is a question from the plan, if implemented, what is your take, and Mr. Kolesh, maybe this is for you or David, on other pollutants? We just had a conversation, you were here for part of it, on mercury this morning. And what happens to the effects on sort of multiple pollutant issues if this rule is effective and is implemented? Just curious on your thoughts about that.
Mr. Kolesh. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The EPA is clear that they anticipate that this rule would also lead to reductions in sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides, and certainly mercury. EPA has both a mercury and air toxic standard, but they're seeing the Clean Power Plan rule as really driving continued reductions in emissions from the coal sector. Coal-fired power plants would be used less. EPA sees that there'd be no more natural gas replacing that, more renewables replacing that, and electric efficiency reducing the amount of electricity needed. So we reduce the number of power plants we need. So it's clear in EPA's cost estimates that there will be conventional air pollutant reductions. Also, they're going to have significant cost or benefits from that because there'll be less ozone, less nitrogen oxide to react in the atmosphere to form ozone, less sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides to react in the atmosphere to form fine particles, and we'll have fewer deaths and fewer illnesses from exposure to those air pollutants. And then certainly compared to natural gas, coal has much more mercury included in it. Natural gas has virtually no mercury within that as a fuel. So certainly we anticipate as we move from coal to cleaner fuels, reductions in conventional air pollutants.
And more specifically in Minnesota, we are certain to see 3 additional coal unit retirements between now and 2020, and possibly more as a result of this proposal, and increased reliance on renewable energy. And those are because of the things that are already in place through our state statutes and resource planning here.
Dr. Foley.
What's the estimate on the effect on the rate cost of electricity with all of this activity?
Mr. Thornton.
No one's gone there yet. No idea. Rates are going to go up.
Well, in keeping with the connectedness that we talked about, the electrons that we run really does connect all of us into that kind of activity. You know, we've looked at this over the years because we were significantly cheaper than both the East and the West Coast in our cost for electricity. Our availability of water and the clean water aspect and then the energy cost decrease made Minnesota much more competitive than a lot of others. So if we have a lot more of an effect of this new rule and what that does to our rate base, the question is, what's that going to do to our economic generating capacity?
Those are great questions, and Dr. Foley, those are great questions, and I know we'll be primarily with the help of Commerce and the PUC looking at those kinds of things. I remember hearing the governor say at a conference not too long ago that we still have cheaper electricity than a lot of parts of the country, but it's not as much cheaper as it used to be. And, you know, I think the real issue is that locally, some of the states around us are not challenged as much by this. And so that does bring some questions to regional equity. It also, you know, it potentially opens the door for multi-state compliance efforts. Because of the grid here, the only power plant in South Dakota really serves Minnesota customers. And a lot of the power plants in North Dakota and most of the wind turbines in North Dakota serve Minnesota customers. So from a regional and a logical standpoint, it would make a lot of sense for us to collaborate with North Dakota and South Dakota at a minimum for putting together a compliance approach to this that is perhaps cheaper for everyone than if we all go it alone. It's just going to be difficult, I think, to try to get over some of the hurdles that are between us on some of these issues.
Dr. Foley.
Thus your comment on artful language to stimulate PCA to look at this, because if we are direct in saying we wish to have Wisconsin increase their cost and have more goals than what we have, they probably would be reluctant to cooperate with us if we do it that way.
I think you're right.
Yes, exactly.
Dr. Foley.
But you know what? Right now, there's not a lot of focus on how to comply with this. The focus that everybody has is trying to understand it and come up with some ideas for, you know, improvements and correcting things that are wrong. I think in the next few months, there'll be more of a shift to, okay, now what are we going to do with it? And we do have some good networks developed where states are talking to each other and at least keeping the options open. Unfortunately, you know, North and South Dakota haven't been involved in those, but they've recently reached out, and we hope that we'll be able to bring them in and you know, begin some communications with them. And there are ways to potentially satisfy our requirement to submit a plan by a year and a half from now that does not immediately rely on working with another state, but that keeps the door open for multi-state, I'll use the term trading even though it's out of favor in these, in this context, but that would leave the door open for trading to happen later as the targets get more aggressive and, you know, people figure out that it really might be less expensive if we do it that way.
Dr. Foley.
Mr. Chairman, and this has already been through the D.C. Circuit Court, so the authority of the PCA or the EPA to do this has already been decided, correct? Isn't this the
That would not be correct, Dr. Foley. Okay. This will go to the Supreme Court.
Okay, I understand, but I think it's already been to the D.C. Circuit.
Well, the question of whether EPA has the authority to regulate greenhouse gases has been decided by the Supreme Court. This is kind of into the weeds, but I'm going to share it because I think it's really interesting. When the Clean Air Act was amended in 1990, the House version and the Senate version were different, and nobody thought to resolve the two differences before the president signed it. The House version would not allow EPA to do this regulation, and the Senate version would. And without getting into any more details on it, somebody has already filed a lawsuit, even though it's probably premature since this is not even a final proposal. It's just a proposal. We know for certain that this is going to go to court, and it's going to take several years to resolve.
And Mr. Jensen, and then Mr. Riddle.
Commissioner, Mr. Thornton, you mentioned that there'll be three coal units retired by 2020. What are they going to be replaced with, natural gas or a reduction or a combination of the three?
Minnesota Power is going to retire Laskin in Hoyt Lakes, and they are going to build a natural gas plant right there. They are going to retire Taconite Harbor Unit 3, and they are not planning a on-site replacement, but they do have additional wind and hydro power that they are going to be bringing in from wind power and separately hydro power from Manitoba that they have in their plans. The Otter Tail Power Plant, Hoot Lake, is going to be retired. That's in Fergus Falls. There is no direct replacement planned for that. I imagine it will be largely renewable energy. And XL, I misspoke, there's four. XL Energy will be retiring the remaining units at Black Dog that burn coal. And they have indicated an interest in a natural gas replacement, but that has not been worked out within their resource plan yet, as I understand it. So I'm not sure exactly what's going to happen there.
Follow-up, Mr. Jensen.
What impact will that have on then the goals as far as...
All of that helps. All of that helps. We've been, one of the things that we've been trying to do, Frank and his staff have spent hours and hours and hours pouring over all of this to try to see, given the target that EPA has for us, what is it going to take to get there? And, you know, as I indicated, because there's a lot of ifs around this, EPA's proposal is not crystal clear about how a number of things would be treated. It implies that renewables, regardless of where they're located, would count. It's not crystal clear on that. And so depending on how that falls out, it implies that it's very clear that existing hydropower doesn't count, but it implies that new hydropower would. And that's important because there are big plans for new hydropower imports from Manitoba. So there's a number of things like that that are ifs. But if all of that breaks the way that EPA has been implying that it would, and given what we know in the resource plans that our utilities have already filed and the and what we know about the requirements of our renewable energy standard and where they're going to be with that and energy efficiency, that's why we are saying that we think the target is reachable. It doesn't mean that we're right on track to get there, but we're on track to approach it, and that's 2030 is a long way off. I think it's reasonable to assume a lot of things are going to happen that we couldn't possibly foresee.
Mr. Riddle.
Yeah, thank you, and I'm pleased to hear that Minnesota is supportive of this proposed rule, and been proactive in reducing greenhouse gas emissions and investing in renewables already, but you're working out ways to structure comments about states that have been dragging their feet, and I imagine some of the states that are objecting to this proposed rule are some of those. And my question is, what power, either incentives or hammers, does EPA have to bring those states into compliance?
Mr. Thornton or Mr. Kolash?
I'll start, and you feel free to add. But if a state does not submit a plan that EPA deems acceptable, they will develop the plan for that state, and it will be federally enforceable. And I would imagine that there are very few states that would like to have EPA come in and tell them how to operate their power grid.
Mr. Kolesh, anything you'd like to add?
I think, Mr. Chair, the only thing that I would add is to emphasize what Assistant Commissioner Thornton said. EPA would write the plan, and then they would basically be responsible for apportioning out whatever responsibility each utility and each coal-fired and fossil fuel-fired generation have in the state on how that's going to be applied. So that's the primary hammer EPA would use is you figure out how to do it or EPA will do it on a federal level, and you'll probably get something very close to what the pathway that they previously identified in the proposed rule. And that may not be to what each individual state likes to do. And so that's the hammer that they would use.
Dr. Foley.
David, is there anything on the horizon relative to electricity transmission loss that may help in this whole deal? We're talking about input production, but one of the issues is a percentage of loss through transmission. Is there anything relative to the physics of transmission that will improve efficiency of getting the electron to the end user?
I don't know enough to give justice to that question, other than I do know that there are wiring technologies and transformer technologies that are being pursued that would reduce the amount that gets lost between the generation station and the user. I think that cost is involved, and it just sort of depends on how those costs can be brought down and how the price of electricity is rising. Clearly, distributed generation is one answer to that, because you generate the electricity closer to where it's needed. That was one of the drivers for Xcel to replace the Highbridge plant with a natural gas plant right there.
Right.
And it's one of the benefits of solar power, because it will be deployed more closely to where the demand is. But that's a great question. I think it's something that we can expect to have a bearing on how states ultimately meet this goal, but it's not something that we can plan for right now, because it's still a little bit out there.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, the physics is the physics. So this whole deal about transmission loss is really an important deal. The state looked at it a number of years ago and estimated about a fourth of the electrons produced were lost in transmission right. impedance. And so that's a huge number, and especially in a state that is relying upon Manitoba Hydro to distribute electrons and have loss, North Dakota wind loss, South Dakota generating plant loss. Improvements in that other aspect of it in transmission to end user really can have a really big effect in how much input you have to either get from existing coal or other carbon burners. And so I'm hoping that as we look at this, we can pay a little more attention to that piece.
Mr. Kolesh.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in addition to what David said, I'd just point out that EPA did make reference to those kinds of actions that a state could take in as part of their block for their reducing the demand. It's difficult to see how we would do that and account for that, but they do recognize transmission improvements could fall into a state's choice for the compliance determination in complying with 111D is an important piece to reduce the amount of electricity needed in the country.
Dr. Foley.
Could I just add again, you know, I mentioned that, you know, given what we know right now, we feel like it's a reachable target, and 2030 is a long time from now. And I think we all have every reason to believe there'll be things like what you've just described, transmission improvements that will make what might now seem to be a challenging but probably reachable target be a very reachable target. In fact, one that might be very easy to breach. It's very difficult to put those kinds of things into our plan. And unfortunately, the plan that we have to develop within a year and a half has to be very explicit about how we're going to get there.
Mr. Chairman,
Dr. Foley.
The nuclear equation always comes up because of the non-greenhouse gas emission aspect of it. What discussions, either among the staff or the interagencies, are we having relative to ongoing nuclear production and working with other states who also had active nuclear production, given the fact that many of our plants are really the first-generation plants that are coming up for either recommissioning or decommissioning?
I'll start out, and maybe Frank has something he wants to add. Mr. Chairman and Dr. Foley, our nuclear plants have licenses through the early 2030s. But we're going to have to Xcel Energy and the Department of Commerce and the PCA are going to have to figure out how we project meeting the 2030 limit that we have in this proposal beyond 2030 with those plants not there. So that's one challenge that we have in submitting this plan. The other thing that I will just mention, and it came up in our stakeholder meeting that we had yesterday afternoon, people are talking about off-ramps in case there's, you know, for lots of good reasons, public safety, one of them, nuclear plants need to be taken offline quickly in an unplanned manner, and whether the rule needs to be adjusted to accommodate for stuff like that. So it is something that people are talking about. I don't think anybody's worked out all the answers yet.
Mr. Jensen.
Commissioner, I just had a comment related to what Dr. Foley was stating there as far as the transmission, but I think there's, and it can't be discounted, is the consumption efforts, the energy-efficient lighting and computer-controlled lighting networks and so forth is really becoming a whole field unto itself. I know just on a personal basis, we completely retrofitted our entire facility with LED lighting, cut our energy consumption in half. Mm-hmm. So,
good point. Thank you.
Remarkable technology.
And just a point of interesting fact I learned at the presentation at ECOS on this was that 1% of the nation's power generation is consumed in water supply. 6% of the nation's power generation is consumed in wastewater treatment. So that's 7% of the electricity generated, according to the facts that were put out, are in industries that are subject to existing, you know, regulatory authority, and innovation is also, and conservation there would be an important factor. And I think, and I've talked with the staff here, that we should try to reach out to the parties that are subject to permit and help engage them in a discussion about efficiencies and technological innovations that might be possible in water supply and wastewater treatment. So I don't know if that potential is fully realized yet as far as energy savings in Minnesota, but it'd be interesting to see what we can learn about the potential there. Mr. Kolesch, did you have any comment on that? Okay. Dr. Foley.
Where are garbage burners in this whole discussion?
Mr. Thornton or Mr. Kolesch?
Seeing that garbage burned is probably a lot like coal in a mass burn plant.
Mr. Kolesch.
Mr. Chair, actually, we have not, there have not been any discussions about additional solid waste incineration. It is defined as a renewable energy source under the state law, but we haven't really had any discussions. No one's brought that up as a source of additional generation. What we've been looking at when we analyze the rule is to take that rate and make it something a bit more understandable. We're trying to come up with what kind of electric generation deficit would we have under different scenarios. So, and then we look at that and say we would likely need to make that up with zero emission sources, wind or solar, or through the and electric efficiency or other of reducing the demand. That's really how we've been trying to look at it, not be real specific to individual sources, but just say under various scenarios. And that's where the basis for Assistant Commissioner Thornton's statement of it, if EPA holds to the things that they've told us and we have the data corrections, we think this is reachable because we're looking at a deficit that is reasonable or reachable that we would have to fill with zero emitting sources. And in Minnesota, I think we have a clear policy direction that if we're going to be making up generation, it's going to we first look to renewable energy and electric efficiency before you start to add anything, any new fuel-based or burn combustion-based fuel for electricity.
Mr. Thornton.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Frank, but I believe that the waste-to-energy facilities in the state are, number one, too small to be regulated under this proposal, and number two, EPA has explicitly, well, not explicitly, that's one of our questions, but they have implied that biomass doesn't count.
Yes.
Did I get that right?
Yes. You'll see there's one of the comments, one of the points in the comment letter you have where it's not clear how EPA is going to deal with biomass emissions because, and when David said doesn't count, there it has been a significant amount of work going on at EPA on how to count the carbon dioxide emissions from biomass, that it's not just zero, but it's not 100% just like coal. It's somewhere in between. It's based on where the fuel comes from. And one of our comments was that when EPA set the goal, they assumed that biomass, and in this case we're talking about wood biomass, was a zero emission source. But they talk about how in the future when we're doing compliance, it might not be a zero emission source. We might have to count some of the carbon emissions, which is the term we're using is asymmetrical treatment of that, and the EPA should clean that up, be clear about that, so states don't get in a position where your goal was set, assuming wood is a zero-emitting source, and then 10 years down the road you're trying to comply, and EPA is saying you have to count a fraction or maybe in a significant amount of those emissions from wood-based burning. And then from the affected sources, I think Assistant Commissioner Thornton is correct. I don't think that any of our municipal solid waste incinerators are large enough to be considered an affected unit by this rule.
Dr. Sampson.
To follow on that, thank you. Along those lines, and I think by asymmetrical you mean they're treating wood differently than the other, than fossil fuels, so.
And they're treating it differently in the goal setting stage.
Okay.
And the compliance state. That's where it could be asymmetric.
Okay. Yeah, and I guess that leads to my question because, you know, everything's interconnected. We talk about water use, and because I was thinking about, well, if we're going to count all of the emissions accurately, it's sort of hard to apportion where they go because, I mean, if we're using natural gas from the Dakotas and but we're mining the frac sand here and you've got power consumption and diesel vehicles moving things around. I mean, there's many layers to the energy. It's not just the energy contained in the cubic foot of natural gas. It's all the energy expended to get to that point as well. So, are they thinking in those layers and that sort of interconnectedness of the whole energy production? Essentially, the carbon emissions associated with energy production to get you that one unit of consumable fuel of some kind, or is that too deep for an already complex?
I think I would, Mr. Chairman, Dr. Sampson, I think the way I would respond to that is because of the structure of the federal laws, EPA has to approach this in a compartmentalized way. They have, you know, some of that you're talking about is off-road equipment that mines coal. For example, well, that's regulated under their mobile source regulations, and they have tightened those up for efficiency to address greenhouse gases. And so this compartment is existing power plants. The other thing that Frank mentioned was the compartment that's new power plants. So yes, it's all interconnected, and it would be great if we could work on it that way because of the federal statutes, they're approaching this in a compartmentalized way. Now, if Congress were to come in and pass an all-inclusive cap-and-trade program, then we could do what you'd like. But until then, I think you're going to see EPA have to address compartments.
And
David, you're absolutely correct as to the answer that has been given repeatedly by Assistant Administrator McCabe for EPA. She has said that over and over again, that the rule comes out of the Clean Air Act, and the confines of the Clean Air Act defined exactly how they crafted the rule. So I think you're asking an important question. It is always the question that is difficult given what we come to learn. We learn things, and then laws don't always catch up with what we learn. And I think that's one of those interconnected and sustainability questions of how are we comprehensively and cumulatively accounting for all of the emission sources and reductions. We don't have a good approach to that yet as a nation. So, no other questions? Then what I will do is just thank you, David and Frank, for your presentation. I wanted to just quickly provide a Deputy Commissioner Beeman with, and I will have one more update for you. That's a good suggestion. Thank you. Cool.
Very quickly, the PCA staff will be having its semi-annual leadership meeting in October. This is where we have all of our supervisors and managers and senior leaders get together and have a full-day agenda on things. It's coming up on October 16th, and one of the agenda items we thought would be different and really beneficial for staff, maybe as well for you, this is an informal invitation, is to have a segment on the board and have perspectives from a few board members who might be interested in coming and participating. And so we have a block that would include lunch, and then from 12:30 to 1:30, this is on Thursday, October 16th, an hour-long panel discussion. And so, again, this is not an official board meeting. It would not be paid in a per diem way. But anybody, we put the invitation out, any of you who might want to come and donate a little bit of your time and have an interaction on the panel and basically sharing your perspective on what it is to be a Citizens Board member, how you approach the issues that you see. Again, not taking up any individual specific decision item. This is a more general conversation. And then at lunch, being able to meet some of our leadership as well. I'll send an email out. I just wanted to flag that because it's coming up, again, Thursday, October 16th. And if you're interested and willing, it's going to be here in St. Paul at a nearby location. Thank you.
Thank you. And just one last comment you may have read or heard, I should have included in my update on the Enbridge pipeline proposal that is currently before the Public Utilities Commission. The agency has been very involved in review and comment on the environmental assessment of alternative routes for the proposed pipeline that both the new pipeline and the expansion of a pipeline that Enbridge has brought before the PUC. We have commented about a number of those what are called route alternatives. They're within the scope of what the Enbridge company proposed, but we've also then proposed some alternative what are called system alternatives. They are new routes for a pipeline. And we provided those comments to the PUC. Bill Sirks has been directly involved from our agency as well as our environmental review staff. We've cooperated with a number of our field staff in generating detailed comments on water and as DNR has on natural resources. And the PUC has taken to heart the comments made, and they are going to require an analysis of alternative system alignments. So that work has been going on. It's going to involve more environmental analysis on the part of the Department of Commerce, who supports the Public Utilities Commission in doing their environmental review. So if you have any questions about that, you can connect through Deputy Commissioner Beeman, and she can put you in touch with our staff that have been working very actively on that. But it has been a very open and good discussion of environmental effects and alternatives, which is
the right time to be having this conversation. As we go around the state and hear about rail complications and the potential for significant growth in the amount of oil and other products moving out of the Bakken Formation in North Dakota. So that's the last update from me. If there's nothing more, motion to adjourn.
I would move to adjourn.
Motion by Dr. Foley, second by Mr. Riddle. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. We are adjourned.